So what's your take on UCLB? I have no idea where you stand these days.
ISP?
They don't give a damn.
No, as long as they operationally work, they're general ISP, so it's warranted.
You're okay, see
this. There's nothing more than needed.
But outside, I think that the operations are great. The one thing that they don't see is...
Have you done any of these before yet? Have you done IQs?
No.
Oh, did I? You just saw the test. Oh, this is very strange today. They've been very well behaved.
Having to.
Yeah. It was.
We should make life easy for IFP.
There's no.
You invited me. You'll probably be nice.
I think I'm not doing
it.
This is not a very efficient way to do it. It leaves one more place. Okay. Somebody did a PowerPoint earlier. No, that was the only one, but I guess if you guys your laptop,
he has implemented this by
Facebook. Which we may have.
They will actually give you a mailbox in their system, to whatever it is before we. Extremely expensive and cumbersome right now to do that. And I've seen my conversation and adding quant at the prices are getting paid.
That's
nothing that is. There's a branding issue there. It's quite logical.
Good.
That they lose the branding that they get for nothing. So their cost increase. They lose an indirect marketing feature that they have.
So they don't have to support it.
Well, no, actually, the person mailing in presumably would know the address and have the name, and then it would get bounced to the website.
No, and if I become .nom,
I'd like to take your seats. We're going to start this afternoon's program.
That's branding. It's very important for us.
You're moderating.
Yes. I'll jump up.
Good afternoon. We're going to resume the Berkman Center for Internet and Society program, ICANN and the Public Interest, Pressing Issues. The panel that we have here is going to consider competition in the top-level domains. Our moderator for this panel is my colleague, Professor Jonathan Zittrain from the Berkman Center. He's the executive director. And he's also the person, more than any other academic, who is actually using high technology and the internet in the classroom as a method for actually discussing and analyzing these issues. And in fact, many of you may have seen the headlines about the listserv for the Internet Society course, 99 course that he's teaching, which has had often very frank and brutal discussion of these issues. So of course our poor little law students are completely aghast at this behavior. And we're lucky enough today to have some of these brutal and frank people with us on the panel. And to who will remain unnamed, they're all wearing masks. No. She's the one that isn't. So I'm going to turn this over to Jonathan Zittrain.
Okay. Yeah, actually, in my class, I use the remote participation system that you see and use at the ICANN meetings. Actually, the students are asked to submit remote comments as well, with somewhat mixed success. Are you dialing me down the right amount then? Okay. All right, great. So we have a lot of people on this panel. One going pseudonymously at the moment. And I'd love to just get some introductions going. So perhaps moving left to right, if you can say who you are and why you think you're on this panel. I'll tell them I'll call them back.
Well, I call myself I was smart enough to invent the CNS, but not smart enough to win it.
So that kind of calibrates a little bit there. I'm here because I have some technical expertise with the Old Testament and can probably also talk to what the Founding Fathers intended, if not what they ended up doing. And I guess I'll wait for the discussion to go further than that.
So you're sort of the Robert Oppenheimer of our crew. Thank you for what you have wrought. Yes, next.
My name is Howard Bill, and my nickname was with the main magistrate, and I suppose I represent the Antichrist
And you are a registry, not just a registrar. So what...
Registrar.
You are a registrar or a registry? I didn't mean this to be a hard question. You're a registrar. Okay, sorry. Delusions of grandeur. Okay, yes. Next.
So I'm Philip Shepherd, I'm a member of the Men's Council, and my day job is working with AIM, the European Trans.
Gotcha. And from what constituency are you a member?
Business
constituency. Thank you. Yeah, Stephen, I read up on your biography. You'll see on the agenda there, biographies of these people. Here is Stephen's biography. Stephen Postrel is a lecturer at the Graduate School of Management, University of California, Irvine, where he teaches business strategies. His research interests focus on trying to understand the production functions of such things as new product design by using interdisciplinary knowledge from different domains as input.
Nothing to do with this, but my
good.
Dissertation was about standards.
Wonderful. Thank you. And I don't know if we've reproduced all of these papers in the briefing documents, but there is in the affiliate analysis document a meta document that describes a lot of these proposals. So, thank you. And our mystery guest.
This is the way they operationally would impact the functioning of the net.
Wonderful.
I'm Jeff Williams. No, I know, I'm really Ken Crispin. I said that once before, I think. I run a small web hosting company, Songbird. I was the chairman of the policy advisory board of the generic top-level domain memorandum of understanding. And that is a, I guess, a particular political point of view in all of this, so I guess that's why.
So you were the chair of the PAB of the GPLD-MOU.
That's correct.
I just wanted to say that. Okay, and last?
Good afternoon. I am Elisabeth Kochner. I am the only one non-native English speaker at this table. I am from France. I am advisor to ASCII. I've been involved in networking for years. I've been the one discussing the International Science Foundation when we are trying to establish international language in the United States.
And you have some position with respect to the Names Council, is that right?
I am also running the DNSO auth server, and I am assuming the network secret.
Wow. Okay, that's a very brave task to be taking on. Okay.
She was also in Working Group C.
Also in Working Group C. Okay. All right, so as the name tags fill out, I'm not sure what name tag our anonymous guests will get, but we will have to see. The first question on my mind is simply, do we at least have agreement, even among a crew as diverse as this, that new GTLDs, whatever they may be, new entries in the root, are something that should happen really soon? Is anybody who disagrees with that? Wow. Ah, okay. I just needed a second there. Go ahead.
It was only really phrasing of your question, because it was new GTLD, whatever they may be. And I think the whatever they may be is exactly the novel question. If it's unrestricted GTLD, whatever anybody feels like is a good idea, then I might have an issue.
Gotcha. But you're not, at least in the first instance, against adding new GTLDs, period. So you want to see the proposal before you decide what you want to do. Gotcha. Paul, do you have a sense of what our parameters are? What are our limits? If it were decided, if there was a consensus around adding a ton of new GTLDs, would you be worried about that? Is there some technical limit on what can be done with the root?
I think that any sensible approach would say that we're going to add a few and see how it goes. One of the things that's bothered me a little bit about some of the process descriptions I've heard before, if it was a physics department, we would get rid of all the empiricists and just keep the theoreticians. What I'd like to do is I'd like to, you know, and we would do no experiments. So I guess the position I would advocate is that we decide to do a limited experiment, do it on a fairly short term. There's lots of worthy candidates. And it may be that we have hundreds, thousands, millions, billions as time goes by, but we have to start generating some of that experience to figure out what the right number is. So let's just start slow and ramp up.
But if 100 were added, would you say then you can't guarantee what would happen?
I'd be willing to take the bet, let's put it that way. You know? I mean, this is a lawyer-like question. Is there any possibility whatsoever that that DNA didn't match?
I have a warranty here for your time.
John, could I jump in here?
Sure, Milton, go ahead.
It's my understanding that Hunter-Cut GLDs have been added at the rate of about 30 a year for the last 10 years, and that we don't have that many GLDs. Well, on an average year, for example, in 1993 or 94, I think there were over 50 added. And in other years, it was much less, and obviously it increased gradually. But it seems to me we have been adding GLDs, and I wonder if there's anything experimental about that.
Any thoughts on that, Paul? Or?
There might have been something experimental when we added the first five, you know, or something. But at this point, I think it's fairly clear that we could afford to add a few more. And we won't see the scaling effects until the number gets to be a lot larger. So I think, I mean, for the purposes of this discussion, can we just all agree that adding 20 would be okay?
And that we'd run into limits that weren't technical before we got to the 20 we wanted.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm speaking from the technical side, right?
Okay.
Judging on the production of new top-level TLDs over the last 5 years, say, it's very hard to figure we can do more than zero in the administrative sector.
Yeah, very good. Now, Kent, you have a proposal on the table that I think you call the Internet Stability Model. Is that right?
That's right.
And this is a proposal that you sort of frame as coming from the technical community as one path by which new TLDs might be added. I'm just curious if you could give us the basics of your proposal.
Okay, right. However, I certainly would not
purport
to be speaking for the Internet technical community. There's a great deal of policy discussion that goes on continuously in these debates. And so I decided to forget all of that as much as I could and try to put together a proposal that was basically purely concerned with setting up TLDs in a way that it would be done in a stable way. The question I was concerned about was what happens if a TLD registry fails, and what could you do to make that the absolute minimum probability, the lowest probability possible? And that was the intent of my proposal. That was everything else went by the side as far as the proposal was concerned.
So what was the basic framework? What were the planks of your proposal? Probably three or four of them, right?
I don't remember. Basic idea was that you have to have multiple registries. They have to be essentially interchangeable so that if one fails, another can take over the job very quickly. You have to have a standard procedure and format and so on and so forth shared among these registries in terms of how they deal with the data, so that the data, when a registry does fail, or when a terrorist bombs it, or da-da-da-da-da, for whatever reason, something happens to one, that the data, which would, as the ICANN rules currently require anyway, would be escrowed, could be quickly loaded into a different registry, and it could take off within a day or two without there being any interruption in registration services.
So you're saying this is all about standardization on the code side. Under the hood, the way these registries were structured was similar, and if one fails, another could take over its TLD. .biz has now moved to a new owner. But it wouldn't be very hard to do.
There's nothing, once you have a functioning registry, there's essentially almost zero overhead to add more TLDs to that registry. And so copying the data from one registry to another, if you have it in a usable, understood format, common among them all, should be relatively straightforward.
And from where would that standard come in your view?
Probably from ICANN. It's not really that, I don't consider that part a problem. For a very large registry like NSI, which has 6.5 million names last count, any database that size could take a little while to copy, and maybe a significant amount of time. But for new GTLDs, which don't have that huge mass already built up, it should not be a big deal. It should be relatively straightforward to copy data from one TLD to another, one registry to another. Excuse me.
Now, Milton, you had a competing proposal, maybe not competing, but another proposal that you authored that has worked its way through Working Group C as well, at least along this dimension. And so far, just sticking with the technical, how does yours stack up against Kent's?
Well, I think it makes for a very interesting contrast in the way we approach things, because he's I think an engineering or computer science person trying to translate his concept of a stable system into a policy. And I'm a policy and economics person trying to translate policies into a technical system. And what I see with the top level domain is a resource. A lot of people have a lot of different ideas about how to use that resource. I want to define a structure that allows entrepreneurs and users and anybody who has a good idea to come along and be able to start up a system, start up a TLD. And all I'm concerned about is the same thing that Kent is concerned about, is just do this in a way that maintains stability. But the difference, the fundamental difference between us is I want the process and the outcomes to be driven by users and the market. And he wants it to be centralized and dictated by ICANN. So what I proposed specifically was, for competitive reasons, ICANN should announce we're going to add 500 TLDs. We're going to take applications from people very slowly, maybe 6 in the first phase, 10 the next phase, gradually build up momentum.
If they say you give out 6 new registries, somebody, take in as many applications as arrive on the doorstep.
Somebody comes to me and says, I want to run the .biz registry, and here's my technical qualifications, and here's my bonded nature and so on, and I'm financially accountable. And they make this grant or they don't. In essence, it's similar to the running of a second level domain, only there would be perhaps more stringent requirements.
And by what criteria in your system would ICANN decide how to pick the 6 from among more than 6 proposals that might arrive to do this?
The beauty of pre-announcing that you're going to add a lot is that it doesn't matter a whole lot who the first 6 are.
There's no first mover advantage in this space.
Right. If there's no proven problems, technical problems that develop in the initial phase, then they accept new applications and keep granting them.
In which case, it doesn't matter to you what criteria ICANN uses, or they could just have it be a lottery, or
In terms of the content of the names or the technical criteria?
I was thinking both what names shall be included among the first six and who shall be designated the entity to manage, the registry to manage each name.
All I care about in terms of those first six is that it's six different registries, so it's competitive and open, and that that they are responding to the initiative of people out there and not trying to impose a particular concept of what they think ought to be the names.
So, Howard, perhaps your announcement that you're a registry, in addition to being a registrar, indicates some future possible business direction you might take.
Well, we're in the process.
So might it be possible that in addition to being a registrar for existing generic top-level domains, your company might seek to be a registry for a new name? That could happen. Not just possible, but perhaps likely. You're not sure. Hypothetically, then, how would you react to the system that Milton has laid out as a potential applicant for a top-level domain? Does that sound reasonable to you?
Well, the idea of openness, competition, is all very reasonable.
And you would be happy to submit your application. You'd have to perhaps designate ahead of time either one or maybe a series of top-level registries you'd be willing to do. I'll do .biz, I'll do .egg, I'll do anything. But, you know, I incorporate by reference the dictionary, and these are the names I'll do, and please choose me.
Yeah, certainly. That'll be fine. We're in the business to serve our customers. We would like to serve our customers in the best way possible. And if that is one route, then that's fine. I think crucial elements here are standardization so that everybody gets the same service no matter who they go to register their domain name. We don't mind competition. That's fine.
So let me ask our mystery guest, who may represent certain internet service providers that also might be interested in such businesses. How does this sound to you?
Actually, I disagree. I think that there are a subset of ISPs who are entering the registrar business so that they can take control of their customer information. That's very important, and the more control you have over that customer information, the more ability that you have to broaden value-added services. So you see some ISPs, but very few actually, because registration is a cost of doing business. So many ISPs will continue to outsource that, have no interest in becoming registrars. Even fewer will consider the registry business in their core competence, the database business. So, I mean, big deal.
So is there actually a sense, then, that there won't be an Oklahoma land rush to be registries? You won't necessarily have...
Not from ISPs. I can't say that there aren't going to be people who are in other areas that are were running databases and customer-oriented business in that way. But the ISP business starts at a bottom level of access provision and works out. So it's not clear that running a database registry, which is a very different kind of business with huge customer service requirements, is in the interest of many internet service providers who are mostly very small businesses.
Gotcha.
From the point of view of process, how to do this, my initial inkling is that something fairly open in terms of letting people start up these top-level domain names makes sense. It's hard to see, I mean, subject to any technical problem if it's going to crash my email or something, obviously I don't want that to happen, but I am a bit more skeptical about the importance of this. Let me explain why I say that. From a user point of view, having a different dot something at the end of the name isn't very important to the way users actually interface with the net. I mean,
You don't see any gold-plated nature to .com.
No. Let me go on. I mean, the point is, if you have bookmarks, you know, you click on your bookmarks. If your search engines take you to places, links take you to places, those things are very important. Now, there are some obviously we see with the IPOs going on that they're, you know, putting .com on the end of various things. Seems to have some effect, and their media campaign out in the real world are trying to embed these things in people's minds. But
we can imagine the public offering for 128.36.0.15.
Right. But the point is, the thing at the end isn't what's really the most important part. It's the part at the front. I mean, if it had turned out to be Amazon.biz instead of Amazon.com, that would be an accident of history. Which name happened to be chosen? I don't think there's anything intrinsic in the particular suffix there that was the thing that did it. Now, to the extent that the world may be changing fairly soon in terms of how the internet works, where it's not, it may well be that people won't really be very interested in all these domain names in another 5 or 10 years. Aside from things like extensible markup language and things
we
that
could all be using internet keywords or something.
Or whatever it is, yeah. Or just from the simple thickening of links over time, where people just navigate from link to link, perhaps. You know, there's a whole set of behaviors that would take place here. And one of the things that occurs to me is, so right now, the .com sort of dominates. It has a, people naturally look for .com type names. In the future, it may be that no one will care about any of these suffixes, or even the same kind of names we're used to using now, as we use intelligent agents or keywords or whatever we're using to get to these things. There is a deeper point here, which is that our attention is limited, and one of the issues that people need is some sort of editing process to know which sites are worth going to. To some extent, that's what directories try to do and so on. We already have pay listing type sites under .com, where if you pay money, they'll put you on the site. You have other kinds of hosting types and mechanisms within the system. It seems to me that the internet in the future is likely to be not a completely even open access community, because customers don't want that.
So you could have topic specific top level.
Yeah, and it may
be
the
.movie.
My point is, TLDs may be a way to do this. I don't know why it's superior to just having something under .com that accomplishes the same purpose, but if it makes it easier for people to enter and to compete and to try new things, then I would be for it. But I'm not sure that it's a positive significance for this.
Now, Philip, you were twitching in a way that indicated some disagreement with Stephen as he got to claiming that there wasn't a big difference between what you call the TLDs as long as you had them.
Exactly. I mean, I come from a background of brands where differentiation is key to both consumer trust and end user findability. And for us, it seems essential that any new system of top-level domain name has to have an element of differentiation for it help the findability of what you want to find on the net. Now, the reason we've all got the problem with cyber piracy and everything else, of course, it's because of monopoly, all invested in .com. We've had a land rush in that. If you move to something else undifferentiated, like we also have .biz or .firm or any other similar nonsense, we end up also with another set, or we end up in an oligopoly in which what you're in also doesn't particularly help the end user find you. You move to something that is better differentiated, it makes sense. Now, what I'd also take issue with the proposal that I had from Mr. Lewis was that you can't leave everything to market forces if you want to have some sort of structural differentiation in the short term. It might end up with okay. But if going back to your suggestion or your example of a topic related one, .movies, what's the benefit to the net user to have .film and .movies and .audiovisual and .mov, etc.? You know, you want one if you're looking for a movie company or somebody doing a movie. And for us, that's the way that we would like to see it.
And again, that's a framework that you figure would be ICANN's responsibility to lay out. ICANN would somehow have to decide, we're going to have new TLDs, but we want to have basically one per category of some set of categories.
If you're going to have some structured categorization, you need a structure to formulate that, and ICANN would seem to be the overall body that is in a position to assist with consultation.
Yes, Mr. Yes.
I would like to just bring out a real point, as many people in this audience may know and some may not know, is that the U.S. government recently has undergone a many year-long process to revise the SIC codes that are used in the United States, for example, to describe businesses. And if anyone's ever had to use zip codes to know in how many thousands of ways businesses are classified, then I think the idea that somehow we can throw out 10, 20, 500 little names and categorize for the purposes of a directory system is beyond absurd.
In a way, it sounds
possible.
Before we come to words such as absurd, Kafka-esque, you say?
Yeah.
It's a more delicate way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like what you're saying is that part of this way of expanding to take the internet domain name system from a white pages-like entity, everything is pretty much in .com, to a yellow pages-like entity, and you say that introduces an extra layer of complexity as you try to figure out what categories are what that you would not like to have to confront.
I would predict that just the debate over whether you're going to use the U.S.-based SIC code versus the European Commission's industrial code classification versus some other international organization's idea of how commerce should be classified will take longer than it's going to take for directory systems to finally come into play in a serious way.
Yes, Milton.
I am at a school of information studies where we deal with things like classification, and I first approached this issue of GTLDs from that perspective, thinking, wouldn't it be nice for users to have a standardized system of classifications? And for precisely the reasons Barbara was outlining, the notions of change, it is impossible to do that. You do not want to have the top-level domain space or any part of the domain space be some kind of a compulsory categorization scheme, because domain names are supposed to be stable over time, and you can't change a classification scheme without resorting everybody into a different box.
So, Paul, let me ask you, as somebody who was there at the creation, we inherit the scheme that now, I guess, de facto is fairly flat, lots of stuff in .com, not a whole lot elsewhere, proportionally speaking, but that has the vestiges of a category-based system. We have .edu, for example, for which I guess you still have to prove to network solutions or slip through their net that you are a 2 or 4 year degree-granting United States educational institution to be within .edu. Or .org was meant for organization. Am I getting this all wrong?
I don't know whether or not that's true. It's certainly the case that there are EDUs outside of the U.S. that are currently registered. At any rate, I'll say something controversial for you to play off of. I think that one of the things that seems to be going on here is that people are trying to figure out how to create the ultimate zero-sum game with regard to the TLDs here. And I'd like to just say that, first of all, I don't think that there's any one policy that I would want to see in place if we were going to create 10 new TLDs. I'd like to try some different policies. And if I'm giving, I mean, the suggestion that there's no first mover advantage, I think, is, well, it's hard for me to accept coming from Silicon Valley. So, everybody wants to be able to have open franchises until they get theirs, and then it should be closed, right? This is used to, I mean, we're familiar with this from real estate law. So I would like to say we should have some TLDs which are completely trademark free, okay? And you can tell the customer you shouldn't go there because trademarks aren't respected.
Dot dangerous.
Dot dangerous. Yes, right. Or, you know, no TL or no trademark
dot
or whatever.
Dot chaos.
Whatever. You know, because the point is that we've got a number of different conflicting kinds of relationships that we have here, and that I think what we need to do is to try a few experiments and to see what happens.
Would that also include then, to your mind, different levels of granularity for the name? So, for instance, would you support .IBM?
Let me just back up one more time. The best example of this in the past was I was at this meeting where they said everybody would want to register under their country codes. All this other stuff is nonsense. No one will ever register in .com. Okay. And the only reason the .com and EDU and so forth that those things were left in was the fact that people said, well, Paul, those will be your folly, and you know they'll die off, and then we'll.
So you're saying you had a chance to take it out, and you didn't.
No, I was advocating leaving it in
because you could have taken it out.
I thought that it was very uncosmopolitan to have, you know, your country affiliation as your most significant bits, right? I just thought that that was kind of wrong. And
.NATO should be for everyone's military.
Yeah, well, we got rid of .NATO. NATO was once upon a time a top-level domain. Most people here don't know that.
Was that Nader or NATO?
NATO, N-A-T-O. Yeah, it was NATO.Nader, I believe, but I'm not sure. So, you know, I just really think that what we ought to do is try and identify some objectives that perhaps are beyond the zero-sum game of commerce, and give them priority in the first few TLDs we try, and maybe we'll give some people exclusive access to registering, and maybe in others there'll be the competitive system. But the point is that freezing the evolutionary stage and building this ultimate zero-sum game isn't helping anybody else.
So I'd love, just before we move on, to ask each of you, this is almost feels like a game show, but we'll go with it, to ask each of you, by the end of the panel, I'd love for you to write down, if you were what Paul once was, czar of the DNS of a source, and you could simply designate the next six GTLDs, what would they be? And I ask because I'm curious to know, at least by way of example, what diversity there would be in your list of these six new GTLDs. So anyway, I give that as a dynamic homework assignment, or panel work assignment to be done as we continue our discussion. There'll be no prize if you match with other panelists. Kent, that sounds a little bit like a degree of diversity that differs from your proposal, or is that not so? I'm trying to figure out if Paul is
vastly misunderstanding that proposal.
Set me straight.
Actually, a second part of the proposal was that there should be what I called, I got this terminology from somebody else, sponsored TLDs, and that the process for getting new TLDs would be that people would come forward with ideas for TLDs and present them essentially in a community kind of setting and say, let's try to get this TLD going. If it got support, then it would be adopted.
And if it be support from?
From DNSO working groups is what I thought about, but some such body as that. And that way, you could have TLDs with any charter or purpose that you could convince people was meaningful. And that was I wanted to have a lot of variety in TLDs. The problem with GTLDs is they have no variety. They are, the only thing that distinguishes them is names, and names really aren't that significant. We're using COM, ORG, and NET. And those are not exactly meaningful names.
So how would you differentiate then? You're saying the
process of getting them approved, they would have a charter that went with the TLD that said what the purpose of the TLD, what the requirements for registration in the TLD were, and so on. How they would be enforced, who would enforce them.
And you wouldn't impose at the outset any boundaries on what the charter might look like. It would not be up...
No.
So you'd be happy, for instance, to see for-profit charters suggested along with non-profit?
I would be perfectly happy to see them suggested. I don't think they would succeed, but I'd be perfectly happy to see them suggested.
And that would be a function of what the working group could come to accept, and then it would bubble up through the DNSO.
The model of working group I had at the time I was thinking about this is slightly different than the model of working group that is evolving in the DNSO. I had more in mind a more IETF-like model where working groups were formed because people were interested in them. So the idea would be that if somebody wanted to form a .med TLD for medical purposes, let's say, that a working group would form around that idea and that they would work out all the details about what would be involved and how it would be enforced, all that kind of stuff, and put together the documents that would be required. You should, for such a case, you should have a formal document that says what the things are. Put together the documents, investigate the legal things, publish it to the world so you wouldn't, that med was a dirty word in some unknown language at this point, that somebody would complain and say... No,
somebody else would want it if that were the case.
Well, yeah, that's right. But that somebody would complain and it wouldn't, that would be part of the factor, that it would be exposed to everybody, as many, a wide circulation as possible, and if there were problems with the name, you would find out about it.
So now Elizabeth looks troubled by this.
Well, I am, of course. As far as .NET is concerned, for instance, I believe that within different countries, you have different, I'm looking for a word, different accreditation to be medical doctor. You cannot just arrive from United States to France and open your medical doctor cabinet. You need to be approved. So if you accept to open .net, for whom it is? For American doctors?
This is my question.
I believe it may be really misleading. If you accept it, I would like to come back a little bit to another question, very important for me. I believe that we need to have to look on experience of .com or .net and experience of CCTLD before we accept to open new GTLD and before we decide under which condition. I was a little bit puzzled by the person from NetNames claiming that registrars may will to open registry, to run registry.
Well, and he was pretty guarded about that.
I believe that it was one of very, very good conclusions of .com org experience that registry function and registrar function should be separated. One of them is monopoly and should be natural to registrars, our French vision, and registrars is competitive market. And if my understanding is that you cannot mix this business. Well, when we arrived to new GTLD, and Ken was speaking about charter as GTLD, well, sounds very good. But how do you enforce it on international level?
Ken, do you have an answer to that? Or?
It's yes, I do have an answer to that, but it's not one I think we would want to spend a lot of time on here. But when I'll just say a couple words about it. Speaking of, you know, how would you enforce a .med charter? And that question presupposes what the charter is. The idea of having these working groups to come up with a charter is that people would ask exactly those questions. And if you couldn't come up with an enforceable mechanism for enforcing membership in the TOB would never get started. .NET is probably not a good example for exactly the reasons you say. There are, however, other cases where it's a lot more straightforward about what can be accepted and what is not. For example, one of the ones I've thought about is .CAM, which is for amateur radio operators. It's completely straightforward to determine whether somebody has an amateur radio operator's license. So you could have, for example, a TLD for which the only criteria for having a name in it was having a ham radio operator's license.
Now, I'm trying to figure out if your example would help or hurt the following problem submitted by Dennis Schaefer, who is somewhere out in the ether. He says, a famous mark holder once claimed to me that they believed themselves entitled to any GTLD registration of their name by dint of their Section 42 trademark classification. This suggests the classification schemes may be essential to avoid a land rush of litigation. So I guess I'm wondering, under your schema, if somebody registered McDonald's.ham, maybe that's a bad example, if somebody registered IBM.ham, the International Business Machines Corporation shouldn't squeal so loudly because, after all, who would think that IBM had anything to do with amateur radio?
Well, my call sign actually is KB6RCA, and I don't know that there would be a conflict in that case. There's just, those are issues that have to be worked. I mean, you know.
Philip, what do you think?
Curiously, I agree completely. Once you've got a very broad system of GTLD, the whole point about the cyber piracy and land rush just goes away. It becomes a quirk of history because it no longer matters if you're going to be a cyber pirate and you're going to rush to put an IBM in an amateur radio place. Nobody gives a damn because they're trying to find IBM where IBM should be.
and the findability then works. And if you randomly come across them and it's something totally unconnected to the business, there's likely to be zero confusion, and therefore it doesn't matter.
So in that instance, would you be also happy to see among the new names something like .chaos, which wasn't meant for any particular classification, but was a catch-all that people would understand was first come, first served, so IBM.chaos would also be unlikely to be IBM?
I'd be impressed if you were able to educate the world that .chaos has that characteristic and therefore qualifies as being a sensible dot as a name.
Huh. Paul, you were shaking your head a moment ago.
I mean, I'm willing to admit that certain parts of the namespace ought to be completely and utterly regulated by trademark law. However, that's not like 100% of it.
But okay. That's the dot chaos idea, and well, it sounds like Philip, who's the closest...
Chaos, I think, is a little bit too negative about it, but...
dot three.
That's right, dot Ayn Rand. At any rate, you know, and I always wonder what would happen if you registered, you know, maybe there's a U.S. call sign kosher.ham, you know, I'm not kidding, but several kinds of trouble.
The system would be crossing the wires of the system and break down.
Yeah, right, but, you know, I mean, I think that there ought to be a number of things that we should be able to identify as being useful, and we can move on to that, but, I mean, I just think that, I don't know, is there anybody here that thinks that if we just have trademark law setting DNS policy in toto, that we might as well all, we should all go home now, right? Somebody would take the opposite position.
I'm sure Milton would agree with that.
Can I wear a trademark hat here? Just for a minute.
That in toto now. This is 100% end-to-end.
I think that's what ICANN was created to do sometimes. But let us move on from that point and make a more important point about this business of charter and TLDs that's not been raised yet. And that is that when you talk about a sponsored TLD that is exclusive, then ICANN must become what we call in the U.S. a public trustee licensing bureau, similar to the Federal Communications Commission in the days of scarce radio frequencies. Before they would hand out a scarce radio frequency, they would go through a very complex vetting process to make sure that you were the best possible person to be representing that community on the broadcast spectrum. And now if you talk about making a .med, which is going to be the only .med, or that's not a good example of a .ham, then ICANN will be conferring upon whoever does that registry a special and exclusive right to be the representative on a global basis of the ham radio community. And this is a major point of difference between Kent's proposal and mine. In my proposal, you have no special status associated with a grant or the TOB.
But just to be clear, Kent, somebody could do .ham, .amateur, .amateur hyphen radio,
right.
And those could all maybe, in a world of expanded... Right. Top-level domains pass muster.
Milton has inaccurately characterized my proposal. There's nothing that grants an exclusive right to determine who is a ham radio operator or anything like this in this proposal.
There's nothing in the proposal that does that, but what I want to say is that you make them go through a political process, which in my opinion will guarantee, just as our experience with public trustee licensing guaranteed, that competing proposals will, if they manage to get through the process at all, they will have several strikes against them.
At the very least, Kent, is it true that your model entails an ongoing supervisory role for ICANN by which, if the charter is violated, if whomever is granted the license to run the TLD starts letting in ham that isn't ham,
no.
ICANN sends them a warning and eventually could yank the franchise?
It's a complicated. This is probably more detailed than we really want to go into it. Just in this panel, but
it's okay to punt. It's fine.
I do want to say a couple words about it. It doesn't. That's not the way that works. That's not the way it's envisioned to work. Let me rephrase that. The idea of proposing a sponsor for a TLD is that the sponsor does take responsibility for whatever contract they sign with ICANN. If one of the examples that has been talked about frequently in the past is a dot museum TLD. There's an organization called the International Council of Museums, which is an NGO. It's chartered through the UN, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea would be that the International Council of Museums, which is a non-profit, it's all these good things,
would ask to be the sponsor for the Dot Museum TLD. And they would, as part of the approval process, they would go through all the details, get documents that said how they're going to do. Part of it would be a contract between ICAM and ICOM, the International Council of Museums, which would say what their responsibilities and so on.
And in your view, would that contract also include a price cap? Would they want to, would ICAM look upon it more favorably if they said, and by the way, we're not going to charge museums more than X?
The sponsor is not a registry. The sponsor is an approval authority for being a member or having a domain in the registry. In the model I had, the registry is just a database company that runs that registry, the Dot Museum registry, perhaps with a contractual relationship with ICOM, but not. It's not exclusive, and those pricing things are just registry pricing things, and they're independent of the relationship with the approving authority and sponsor.
Can I make a very quick and sharp contrast?
Yeah, and then we'll open it up.
Under my proposal, the International Council of Museums comes to ICANN and says, we can run a registry, and we want it to be .mus. And ICANN says, you're first in line, you're the first museum group, okay, here it is. 10 years later or 5 years later, if there's a splinter group of international museums that says, we want to have another TLD.
Only postmodern museums.
TMUS. Again, they just have to meet the minimal technical and financial criteria and they get their TLD. Under his proposal, this new group has to go through a long working group process and get the approval of working groups, which are almost certainly going to be dominated by the people who already have TLDs. That's the difference.
You beg to differ with that.
I beg to differ with that, but that's
perfect. Okay. Sir.
Hi, I'm Robert Curry. This is your line. It's all for engineering. As Paul can obviously argue far more eloquently than I, what we have here is a completely recursive system, which 9/10 of the questions and comments I've heard so far are true of TLDs, second-level domains, third-level domains, nth-level domains. And I'm really curious about getting something that perhaps restates the obvious for me as to what is unique and valuable about the G. Because everything else we said so far is the challenges of any other operator of a registry. The reason this comes up is in the context also of XML namespaces. So you've heard the hype around extensible markup language and who gets to define the fare tag for airfare, say. Or let's say more in the travel context, day. Now, day means 24 hours to the auto industry. It means 3 p.m. to 8 a.m. in the hotel industry. And it means the local time zone of departure when it's an airline ticket. That's one where the resolution of the XML community is one to properly let the namespace maturity reflect the social maturity of the organization. So you would go to airline.iata.it. If the museum company wants to sponsor a namespace, it is the museumsociety.org/ and then their namespace for the museum. This goes to the question of what is the value of the G for the purposes it's intended for. To the degree that you're trying to solve a problem, as is popularly understood, of web page access, this is a perhaps there's no straight dividing line between the domain part of a URL and the /path part of a URL. And the authority of the namespace is just another organization that needs an entry into the DNS table, and you exit out of there and into their land of their namespace at that point.
So
what's G?
So do you think, just to ask a question back before we put it to the panel, do you think then that much of the fight over new GTLDs, whether it is expansion of the namespace at all, or who shall inherit them once it's decided it will be expanded and what it should be named, it's basically a misplaced fight. Most of the fighters are actually fundamentally misunderstanding what things are about, and if they were properly reoriented, they would...
The fight over meaning is indeed of extreme value. What makes the Getty a museum or more of a private playground? What makes Day going to mean something at United.com and something else at Hyatt.com? And what makes sense in the cases of communities arguing meaning is for there to be an escalation of the social agreement. So it's originally going to be a DTD, a document type description that points to United.com/reservation/beta35/this week, this is our vocabulary. And then as it gets approved by more airlines, more interchange happens, it may promote. It may now be that both United.com/fare and Delta.com/fare point to the same definition. And over time, perhaps it gets reapproved by another organization, so it becomes a definition of the type under IATA.in, treaty organization. So that's the analogy we're trying to make here, is that maybe the issue of splinter groups is such that they should be visibly splinter underneath some other authority, that you need to reflect as much of the organizational complexity as there. But simply saying, let's push it up a layer, is asking the same questions again.
Paul, my guess is that you understood the greatest percentage of what he said. Tell me what you think.
You know, to some extent, there is value in the .com designation, in the sense that it says that all these companies are registered under .com. And one of the things that you can tell is if they own the name, they were at least had enough financial throw weight and legal capability to fight off the other people who wanted it. Okay, so that there is a certain certification process that goes into being in .com. From a technical point of view, there's some small differences about being in the GTLD having to do with root server traffic and so forth. However, I think the guys who are building computers and the guys who are building fiber optics are way ahead of the curve of us creating new TLDs, seeing as, you know, whatever the Moore's law says, you double every, what is it, every 18 months,
I understand.
Right? And the ICANN law says you double never, and
you double the ICANN bureaucracy every 18 months.
Whatever. At any rate, you know, but just getting back, we all have different views here, and I'd just like to go back to saying, let's try a few different things. And I would like to see a system where there's at least one idea that I think is violently brain dead, okay, that's also being tried out.
And they get to see it go down in flames. And
yeah,
I told
right.
them
the idea is maybe they get to look at me, but I would suggest that what we really need to do is not figure out which of the panelists here has the right recipe, but actually to figure out what the best maybe three or four recipes are out here and try them all out, right? And that's about all I can say. So I don't claim to have a magic formula. I don't think anybody has a magic formula. I don't think anybody can predict what the right answer is.
So no one can predict what the purpose of this is as well. I mean,
there's obviously some people, you know, like, for example, no disrespect, but, you know, if you didn't try and get into both businesses, then your stockholders should try and get you removed, okay?
You're just trying to get to the panel without the stockholders getting mad.
You know, so, that, you know, you should expect that, but I think what ICANN should be trying to do is to figure out some new and advanced and, you know, common good kind of things, and the velociraptors will take care of their own businesses.
So we're starting to run low on time. I want to make sure we get to everybody who's in line right now. But our mystery guest is looking
yes.
upset as
it's
is Philip.
Yes, it's Paul's buddy.
I have more than one friend.
Yes. the DNS buddy, Paul Bixby, made a comment that somehow keeps escaping the panel. DNS is not a directive system for marketing. So we are not going to solve the marketing and branding issues of e-commerce companies in the existing world that is transitioning into e-commerce through the DNS. And you ask, why do people want these other things and why they're not willing to do something after Slash? And the simple reason and answer existed 3 years ago. It doesn't fit on a business card. Done.
No, the length of a dot and a slash is exactly the same.
No slashes. You have to have short, sexy names to do marketing and branding.
Slash Getty.
And
that's it.
No, it's not just that. We discussed that, and you can't have 1 or 2 million of them right now introduced with ensuring in a commercial system that won't crash.
Okay, let's keep it rolling. Philip, quick comment, and Ken.
I'm just impressed that I'm the only one actually who hasn't mentioned these trademarks what I didn't mention earlier, though, was consumer, net user, and findability, and I still think that should be the basis of everything that we're trying. Mm-hmm. And that differentiation I was talking about applies equally to the non-commercial world as it does to commercial world.
Comment.
I just wanted to make a quick comment about the idea that DNS is totally recursive. DNS as an abstract entity is totally recursive, but DNS registries are not recursive. They're at each level of the DNS, it is used for different purposes. At the level of an end user who has them, they register names for their own machines and so on, and or stuff like that.
But just to be clear, that is a description of praxis rather than of technical necessity, right? ML.org at one point was handing out thirdlevel.ml.org.
Well, exactly, but it is important to realize that DNS is not uniform through the levels. It has different behavior at different levels, so it's not fair or not accurate to claim there's totally recursive.
Gotcha. Next person. I really want to get
to. Good afternoon. My name is Eric Mingy. I'm Assistant Chief Counsel with the U.S. Small Business Administration. We agree absolutely with the comments of Meet Incognito. We think that the use of the DNS as a directory service probably will not work. It was not designed to be that way, from our estimation, and also it doesn't seem to be the best tool to do that. Second of all, we also have another issue that was brought up to us, that if the top-level domain is tied directly to a type of business you're in, what happens if you change your business? What happens if someone else determines if you change your business? For example, WWF might be .sport, but maybe after the Sable incident, they should be in the .adult. Who's going to determine those sorts of things? We're very concerned that if we start getting into GTLD being tied to a specific type of business, but then you're going to have some sort of viewing party to decide whether or not they truly are, and then he will decide that. And the answer is I can. Are they then determining the content of the internet web pages themselves?
Very interesting. With the indulgence of the panel, let me just keep rolling with a couple more comments so that we stay on time.
We should just do up or down from
like the McLaughlin group. Yeah. Can hold up numbers like, you know, East Germany 6.0.
My name is Satoshi Nohara from Media of Japan. Lady's comment is very suggestive on CCTLD competition. The CCTLD operation is a potentially de facto monopoly. So to facilitate competition to accomplish better service, we need to encourage competition by separating functions of CCTLD, rail fees and rail cars, and defining the each laws and responsibilities of lease fleet and lease cross, and also encouraging new entries to other new lease fees and new lease cross first and new registries at the second in the future. So what do you think about these kind of ideas? Facilitate competition on CCTLD operations.
Any 15-second comments? No.
Well, the concept that separating registrars and registries deals with the competition problem or somehow makes a registry competitive that when it wasn't before, I do not agree with that idea. I think that what it does is it makes the business of registering names, and which is something that a user does maybe once every 2 years or updating his contact information, it may or may not be economically efficient to separate those functions. It really does not impress me as a way of introducing competition into the process. I think the real way you get competition is by having new registers.
Gotcha. Elizabeth, 10 seconds.
10 seconds. I am just trying to figure out what I understand by CCTLD competition. One CCTLD .fr is a monopoly. .fr is for French. There is a competition between registrars, but it may happen that .fr sets up rules which are too restrictive, for instance. And in such a situation, the competition with the CCTLD being not democratic to some extent, this competition will come from .com.org.net, because in this GTLD you may be able to open domain name and user. So I see, it is not correct to put it this way, but there is, within GTLD we may have a pressure on CCTLDs, which are related to countries, to be open, to be run in a correct way, with the correct rule. I see it a little bit that way. Thank you.
Okay, next, quickly.
Well, yeah. I mean, James,
LaLand, and I represent the concept for the expansion that I don't believe has been heard yet. It's called Simplified Domains. And really, I think it's somewhat irresponsible for this organization to lead the public to believe that these extensions actually mean anything. For instance, .ham, but it meets, will register for a license and get tastyhoney.ham, and the public is being led to believe that these actually mean something. So the simplified concept is that we open up 46,000 new domains, which is every extension that has a possible 3-digit.
So this is just kind of like a license plate now, .xr1, and then no one
will
believe.
Well, what you would have is that John Deere would be a .ere, and if you put in John Deere, you will go to John Deere. If you put in johndeere.com right now, you will not go to johndeere.com. So this concept would also cure the trademark issues because...
Until John Deere and Mark Deere...
Well, no, John Deere owns the name John Deere. Try and go use that and see what happens.
I just thought, you know, Mark Deere Plumbing or something.
Okay, well, that would be fine, Mark Deere, but it would be a .ere. Okay. It's something the public can count on. So when you're driving down the road and you see a .xxx, so to speak, any one of the 46,000 potential possibilities, you'll know that's a domain extension.
Gotcha. Interesting.
SimplifiedDomains.com.
You heard it here first.
Paul McZee's original proposal was to do exactly that.
Annabelle, I hesitate to ask if you can keep it short, but
You are allowed to try. Nobody has succeeded so far.
Ben, you have the clock. Well, Ben went away.
Okay, that's right. Anyway,
I'm on the hard
one. I just want to say something that in the meantime, Elizabeth has started to explain. Look, if we are talking about GTLD competition, GTLDs do not compete. First, because names do not compete. Enterprises, organizations compete. So we are talking about competition in domain and registration market. And registries only compete, if you look at that, from the supply side. They will try to fight for the same customers. But from the demand side, which is really critical here, there are, let's say, only very partially and very imperfectly competitors. In the sense that if I am a medicine doctor working at .net, the fact that somebody has offered me .caos really does not count at all. Indeed, some of them are good substitutes. I mean, probably .com and .biz, perhaps, not always, but partially, they are able to compete. But only before I register. Once I have registered in the aftermarket, I'm completely bound to that register, so it has a really natural monopoly nature, even if partially and imperfectly competes with other registers.
Amazon.com is tied to .com right
for
now.
The rest of
it
the life.
Easily move to
yeah. So if the natural, if the register is largely, not completely, but largely a natural monopoly, a monopoly that's natural, that is inevitable, we should try to make that the most benevolent monopoly we can afford. To do that, we should sever all, you know, take off all the parts we can. One is setting the policies. Well, we take that off and we send that to ICANN, perhaps, something else, many different bodies. Well, I prefer ICANN. You can have any other answer. On the other side, the role of getting consumers and setting prices and services can be done by competing companies. That's the registrar business. But you still have one part, one core part, the database management. And this still is an actual monopoly. What do you do with that? For-profit, non-for-profit, I don't care. What I care is a system that's self-healing, that reduces the need of oversight. 500 companies being, at the same time, registries and registrars and being for-profit is probably the worst scenario. A scenario where this is not, I mean, I've been working for many non-for-profit companies and institutions to know how they can inflate their costs. Having an open membership with objective, non-discriminatory criteria membership group is probably the best solution for reducing the need of oversight to this natural monopoly.
I'm the Wicked Witch of the Stopwatch today. And
last
this is
one.
The last question.
Shannon, go ahead.
Great, thanks. Can I speak here? I'm a reporter with the Red Herring magazine. What's already happening now is a test bed, but it's probably going to be on your radars very soon, is the internationalization of the DNS. All of the talk of the GLDs has been about ASCII code and the Latin alphabet. soon will are limited only by our imagination and other countries' languages, other languages. So I'm wondering what your views are on the panel of an internationalization of the domain space for non-Latin alphabet domains, and also specifically at the top level. Hmm.
Anybody in particular that wants to take the 5 seconds we don't have and weigh in on that?
I'm in favor of it.
Yes.
All right, well, hey, it's done. It's great.
It's already happening.
So, Elizabeth, what are your six names?
My six names? No one.
You don't
no
have
one, them? No one, until we are not sure that we are not going to make too much harm to the economy. We are all dependent on current economy, and I am still a lot of doubt. Absolutely. I'm sorry, no one.
Okay, you get an F. Ken?
I would just add the core TLDs.
You just add?
The core TLDs.
The core TLDs. Oh, the capital C.
GTLD, MOU, TLD.
The GTLD, MOU, PAB, POC, core.
Those TLDs.
Okay, sorry. Mystery guest.
None, or the three letter nonsense extensions that have no meaning.
Ah, interesting. The heard it here first dot ere sort of thing.
It's actually the Vixie proposal.
The Vixie proposal. Milton.
I refuse to play that game of picking the names because the principle of my position is that the ICANN should not pick the names. That they should be picked by people who
That's like saying I'm not in favor of any particular legislation. Whatever the Congress passes, I'm happy.
No, it's not like that. We're not passing legislation. I'm in favor of giving the first 6 ballot proposals that come to ICANN.
Right, have to have a time stamp that registers microseconds, but I hear you. Steve.
I don't believe in enforced semantics from the top either. I think you should be just like any other business names anybody wants to come up with. If you want, you know, entrepreneurial suggestions, you know, dot hate, dot God. I don't know. But I really don't know exactly what the growth areas for the future are, and I not in that business.
So 5 panelists, I've extracted 2 names. Go ahead, Philip.
Jonathan, you clearly learned nothing from the monopoly.com by offering us only 6 names. And if we're to go ahead with a free-for-all system, I will offer you .confuse, .badface, and .anarchy, as well as .ripple. It's a nice example of where this sort of free market is happening today for the benefit of consumers and end users. I offer you .russia. So finally, I offer you .thinkdin.
Thank you very much, I think.
I want
Publishers Clearinghouse .ripoff. It has a nice kind of sound to it.
That's
Howard.
I'm not going to give any top level
our most guarded panelist of the day.
Certainly. Yeah. I think the idea behind the main name is possible. Right now, in terms of if you want names, you go to netnames.com.
Well, Eric Bruner actually asked me to represent him at this panel, and I was kind of loath to do that. But in the absence of a better cause, he wanted to give a TLD to indigenous nations of people of North America.
That gets out of the 3-character limit.
No, I mean, you know, we could think about various 3 levels. I won't say what name, but frankly, I think that enfranchising a group like that with a top-level domain would be better than the choices I've heard so far on this panel. So I would put it up there, and it would be the leader. Myself, personally, I would like to create a new TLD that's an opt-in or opt-out phone book where if I own a particular telephone number, I can decide whether or not it's listed in that, whether or not it's listed in the inverse one, and if so, who's allowed to find out what my current phone number is. There's no phone book, for example, for cell phones. So I would have a user-controlled phone book that you could opt in or opt out and have access privileges.
You can talk to the motion picture guy that was here before lunch.
But I would look to some other people. In fact, it seems like we have no problem here figuring out what the first 2 or 3 new top-level domains are. I think we've got 3 suggestions out of our expert panel, so the picking should be pretty easy. We're undersubscribed.
Diane, did you make a list, or you were? All right.
Would have to put the ampersand in, or is that Andy?
So it's a difficult challenge in just over an hour to feel like you've made progress on an issue when there are so many issues around and so many of us have heard it all so far as we're concerned. But somehow, while I might have trouble identifying just what I've learned, I feel I've learned something. So please join me in thanking the panelists at least for not rending each other. And we proceed next, I believe, to openness and transparency.
Ben? Do you hear me, Ben? Ben? Yeah. Do you hear me? Ben? Why don't we do that? Yeah. Charlie for us.
Tamar?
Yes.
She's saying yes. Can you hear me? If you can
yes,
hear me,
I
wave.
Hear you. Do you know who starts?
Tamar, can you wave your hand?
Hello?
Can you wait? Do it, please, for a sound test. Thank you.
Well, do you want me to talk? Okay, we're talking as well. Waving and talking.
What?
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please take your seats again so we can bomb through the rest of the program? John? Thank you. Okay, our next session again involves the wonders of technology. We're going to have three panelists here in Los Angeles and a fourth panelist commuting from Boston. Tamara Frankel will be on the screen. This session is going to think about transparency and openness. These are also obligations that appear in the registry and the registrar agreement. So this is a burden on ICANN, but it's one that hasn't been defined with anywhere near the specificity of consensus. Again, we will have Charlie Nesson to lead us through this path down transparency, and he'll introduce the panel for you.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you. The subject of this panel is openness and transparency. It was just about a year ago at the first ICANN meeting that I attended in Cambridge when the issue of openness first came up to my knowledge. And it was at that time a really contentious issue. It was a problem with new board members just beginning to meet for the first time, and what were the circumstances under which they were going to meet? Was it going to be open, or was it going to be more in the culture of the corporate world, which is closed? And the initial direction was for closed meetings, and it produced, as you know, a tremendous amount of pressure, and now some movements. But the issue at this point really is, well, how should it work? How do you balance, on the one hand, this need for openness in order for people to trust what's going on, and at the same time, this need for intimacy for people to actually decide difficult things? And certainly when you think about how you decide things in your life, I suspect that you do it face-to-face with people that you trust. And requirements that you do it otherwise will definitely feel like it gets in your way. So I wanted to ask this panel, and it includes Tamara Frankel, who is off somewhere in cyberspace, and when there she is, a little bit out of focus. Hello, Tamara.
Hi.
Wonderful to hear from you.
It's good to hear from you.
I wanted to ask this panel for help on this problem. On a hypothetical, it's not too hypothetical for people, but suppose it's me. Suppose I'm a board member of ICANN. And the question is, how much of my life is now public? What is it that I actually have to divulge, and when? I live on the net. Email is my life. I get up in the morning and I download a pile of it. I send a pile of it off. I communicate with all sorts of people. I send some documents every once in a while, attachments. I, every once in a while, go to meetings. How much of my life is now open? Now, can we get some introductions? Tamara, let me start with you. Would you introduce yourself to our audience?
Oh, I'm Tamara Frankel. I teach at Boston University Law School. I'm a fellow of the Berkman Center. Got involved last year very deeply and passionately, I would say, in the creation, development of ICANN, and still am. Thank you.
Great. And Simon?
I'm a lawyer in Los Angeles. I'm a law student
in a prior life, I was general counsel of a federal agency that lived under all of the government transparency restrictions, and in that capacity may be able to shed some light around here.
Great. Dave?
Dave Crocker. I'm a consultant. My role today is to speak as someone who's been involved for a long time in the Internet Engineering Task Force, the body which is often claimed to make most of the Internet standards, and that was true for a while until all these other standards groups came along. And we have a process for making standards that is unusual as standards processes go and unusual as social decision-making processes go. Many people have wanted to say that it works only because it's a technical community. Most of those people haven't been present to watch the kind of fighting we do.
Ann?
I'm Ann Taylor Schwinn. I'm of counsel with John Holland and Allen at 72 Oakland. I've written a book studying the 50 state statutes governing open meeting requirements in the 56.
All right, so my thought in approaching this problem is to play off some other structures. Ann, you are on top of open meetings. Simon, you're on top of SEC and disclosure rules in that kind of context. And Dave, you come out of this IETF background. How much of my life is going to be public? Tell me, if we were dealing with open meetings, Ann, What would the rules be to us?
Well, when you're meeting as a board member, some meetings would have to be open to the public. Others, in every state, you would be entitled to hold certain meetings for certain subject matters. Each state permits limited closure of meetings for a list of 5 to 25
Give us an idea when I can meet with my fellow board members in executive session.
Personnel matters, privacy matters, if it deals with students, individual students, attorney-client communications, settlement of litigation, purchase and sale when you're discussing the negotiating position that the public body should have, things of that sort.
So,
can I say something? I think that there is a reason, there should be a reason for, and there is a reason for closed sessions, and that is when people want to be able not to take a rigid position, to talk only to each other and not to the outside world, and also to negotiate, to be able to say, I was wrong, I made a mistake, and I would like to change my mind. It doesn't mean that afterwards you don't have to disclose your decisions, your reasons, your arguments, but the first meeting can and should, I think, be closed.
So, Tamar, do I hear you saying that the approach you would favor would be one that allowed closed meetings as long as there was a requirement for people to explain their reasons fully once they came into an open situation?
This is too broad, because what Anne said, usually you will find that these are meetings in which there's either negotiations or there is some matter that ought to be confidential. But on top of it, I would say that these are methods that deal with management also. There's a time element too. When you need to make a decision, like right now, and you can't have all the paraphernalia of an open meeting. So it's kind of a managerial, corporate type of decision. And sure, I can't give you exactly the lines, but I think they develop over time. And if the board steps too close to a closed meeting, then there will be reaction which will bring it to a more open meeting on some issues.
Simon,
Before I go to meetings, I send emails to my fellow board members, and we have discussion back and forth about the issues. Should my email be open? Should everything go up, public record?
Well, let me... I hate establishing transparency as a goal, frankly, for many of the reasons Tamar talked about. I would much rather establish as a goal translucence, enough to see the light through, but not enough to see everything that's going on. And it seems to me that for effective decision-making, for all of the reasons Tamar suggested, and I know Tamar talks about the full breadth of possible decisions, as opposed to Anne's discussion earlier, where clearly some areas should be limited. I would agree with Tamar that the full breadth should have some permissible degree of communication among board members, some degree of discussion, the opportunity to say stupid things without the world watching, and yet a subsequent opportunity to find out basically what went on.
So I don't know how you work with email. The way it works for me with email, I'm sort of present. It's sort of like I just do it. It works fast, and sometimes I'm a little stupid. Sometimes I
mean, I bet I'm stupid more often than you.
I bet I'm stupid more often than you. So are we looking at that going up?
I would hope not. On the other hand, there should be enough available to find out generally what went on, and there may be circumstances under which one would want to be able to retrieve everything where a particularly questionable decision were made. If an award of an extraordinarily valuable domain name were made to your sister, for example, then one might want to know everything that went on. But in the ordinary case, I would think not.
So maybe there are some cases where an investigation gets launched and subpoenas get issued and I have to produce things under compulsion. But what you're saying is, in the ordinary course...
The presumption should be against that kind of detailed interrogation.
Dave, what do you say?
I think we're in trouble. Representing the lunatic fringe of the engineering community that has been doing standards in this peculiar way that has been characterized as having no rules and it's all completely open, except it turns out if you look at the realities of it, we have an enormous number of rules. A great deal of it is actually quite closed. I've been intrigued over the last few years to hear people lobbying for complete openness. Everything must be out in the open. My expectation was sitting on this board, I'm going to be representing one lunatic fringe, and the government, the people who have been running government processes represent what is really a quite different lunatic fringe, each of them having their own reality and very little overlap, which is why I'm fascinated. Simon's use of the word translucence to me is exactly the right balancing effort. There are things that are important to do in public, and we can debate what they are, but there are other things that need to be done privately because they work better that way. And the idea that everything must be completely out in the open is probably the single most impractical idea, and it looks like there's some agreement about that.
Mm-hmm. So, Dave, do you think that ICANN is in any different or in some special position given its particular history? That is, the background of ICANN was that we start with a formation of a company with 9 directors who were chosen by a closed process, by a process where John Postel dubs the people. And, all right, they're great people, but it was not what you would think an open process. And it gave rise to this suspicion and a desire to somehow proceed in a way that generated trust for ICANN. Does that put ICANN in a different posture with respect to openness and perhaps IPS?
Well, my sense of the history was slightly different than yours. I think the mistrust was there before the creation of ICANN. It's just ICANN inherited it. And,
fair point.
And how does one overcome the existence of mistrust? Because for example, ICANN had opened a meeting in Singapore, and so this, of course, increased trust a great deal, didn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think so. And I was just fascinated to watch the reaction some people had. Some people who, I think, want to mistrust said, oh, they had unanimous votes. They clearly had agreed on everything beforehand, and so forth. Another piece to the problem is that the model of treating ICANN as a sort of a government bureaucracy, invoking the government model, is, I think, marching it down a path that is not very productive. It has a very narrow goal, very narrow set of activities it's supposed to be in charge of. In a very mathematical way, you can call some of that governance, but it's not real governance in the larger sense that we worry about governments affecting our lives. And if we keep, I'll finish just one second, tomorrow. If we keep things much more focused, I think we find ourselves less concerned with the mistrust. Not that we have to have automatic trust, but that we can invoke other models for trust than just the openness one.
Tamar, you have something?
Yes. ICANN is unique because it has a combination of managerial, political, and technical functions. That is one of the problems, that you can't really apply any particular model, and what you have to do is ask yourself, what is the function that ICANN is performing now? It is not unitary in the context of openness. When it comes to making decisions, policy decisions, it is very similar to a government. It applies, it affects many interests all over the world. And by the way, that kind of a decision does not require immediacy right now, and should be, I think, open, should involve the process of proposals, comments, and decision that ends with an explanation and of why. And if you do it that way, that, I think, is where the trust can be built.
Well, let me come at it from a different viewpoint. You say, let's look and see what functions ICANN is performing. Let's look at what functions openness is performing. My understanding of ICANN is that it's a balance between, it's in its ideals, in its conception, the challenge in front of the people trying to create this entity is to reify the idea of a balance between the proprietary domain on the one hand and the internet community at large on the other, the public domain. And that public domain is made up of all the people who don't have the funds to travel around the world to respective ICANN meetings. That is, their only way of really accessing is to the extent ICANN is open. Does that put a particularly powerful valence on openness?
I think so. I think that part and decisions, policy decisions of this sort should be viewed and should be modeled after a governmental model. And by the way, when you look at independent agencies, they also have a variety of models. They sometimes are judges, sometimes are legislatures, and sometimes make other types of decisions. And in each case, they have a different process. And that's fine. It can be done.
We have in our audience, is it okay if I call in Ms. Bacon, get you up here somehow? We have in our audience a real-life board member of ICANN, whose real-life life is in some way under the gun with this process. Greg, would you feel comfortable with your email correspondence going public? Would you step up? That's great. You're on the mic.
Charles, the issue is whether my life in ICANN is public, not my private life, my trust.
Depends which is more interesting.
Well, I think my private life hopefully is more interesting.
Some elements of your non-ICANN life
impact your eye can light.
Indeed, because it forms the man that I am, and some of the other activities I'm involved in have similarities with what ICANN is trying to achieve, and that certainly influences my position quite a lot. I'm reminded that it's just 12 months ago that a group of 9 people met in New York. For most of us, it was the first time we'd ever met. We talked about how we would get this organization up and running, and one of the issues was, should we have open board meetings? A number of us, and I was one, argued strongly against open board meetings. We wanted to be a body that got things done. We wanted to be a body that was acting in executive mode, not given to grandstanding or politicizing. And whether that's true for the future or not, I think one thing that has achieved, these 9 people who didn't know each other have formed a very strong and coherent working group with only about 4 physical meetings and a number of phone meetings. I don't think we could have done that if we'd gone into the process right from the start with open meetings.
Well, Ian, tell me, under open meeting strictures, is it possible for board members to get together without the public looking in, without going through this, yes, we have to go into executive session because of personnel or something else?
In virtually all states, that would be a violation.
So Greg couldn't meet with another board member for a dinner beforehand and talk things over.
In fact, that's frequently the result of the cause of a violation and an invalidation of whatever decision the board made at the subsequent meeting.
So in fact, you deliver 2 calamities at once there. First, I can't even sit with Greg and have dinner.
Right.
And second, if we do, the decision that we take tomorrow on which the next 2 months of activities get based may get voided by some court because we had dinner.
Right, and it may get voided by some court 8 months or 18 months later when you can't put the egg back together.
Do you consider this to be an unmitigated disaster?
I think it's a very distressing issue. I think in many communities it means that people have to be worried about going to the same church or being on the same PTA.
So turn around and be constructive for me. Now, you're an expert on... Oh, stay up there, Greg. You're too good at it. I'm sorry.
I'm very worried at the trend of this conversation.
I know. He's tired. He's just come in from Australia. How many hours on the plane?
Oh, I don't know. 14 minutes.
Oh, this is the best time to get him, then. There's another microphone over there. You can sit down.
Yes, great. How about that?
Come into it.
How about that? Have a seat. So, Ann, as our expert, turn around and consult. Help I can. What should our rules of openness be? We don't want to go into something crazy where courts set aside things 8 months later. We do want people to be able to have dinner with each other. We do want to engender as much trust out of this process as possible. And yet, we still want to have executives like Greg feel like this is a do-it organization. How do we do it?
I think the maximum amount of sharing of information before decisions are made with maximum public input. And I think the internet offers that option because people can post messages and comment on other messages and exchange thoughts in a very open and freewheeling way that most closely mirrors the situation that occurs with a school board or the most local of local organizations in which the open meeting concept also works.
And Simon, you come from the SEC background, where your concern with openness has to do with worries about fraud, regulatory concerns.
Well, let me distinguish the SEC as an agency that regulates corporate disclosure from the SEC that's an agency with its own disclosure concerns. And both of those are implicated here. On the corporate disclosure side, the SEC view has always been that one is entitled to enough information to know who is making the decisions and what conflicting interests they may have. And that's enough. And how they go about the decision-making process is not viewed as important. As a public agency, the SEC itself, I think it's useful to look at the 3 sources of forced openness, if you will. One is the Administrative Procedure Act, which requires notice of rule proposals, public comment, et cetera, and goes to the sort of the annual stuff. One is the Freedom of Information Act, which allows you somewhat to dig in and find out what happened when there are suspicions around.
Allows you to get back these beautiful sheets with black written all over.
Yes, sometimes. And one is the Sunshine Act, which you referred to questioningly a moment ago as an unmitigated disaster. And that is the problem, that openness in Sunshine Act terms means never closedness. It means you cannot have closed meetings, you cannot have collegial discussions, you cannot build trust, you cannot have the opportunity to be foolish or to correct your prior views, as Tamar was talking about earlier. And that's the problem. One can have closedness and still periodically have open meetings, and I would think an organization like ICANN should.
So, Dave, can you help us put it together here? I want to open up for questions and get our audience in, but can you help us put it together?
I will help you put it together by noting that I think it's being put together quite nicely, both sides of me. Comment that you heard that I want to resonate off of in particular was the need for open input, the participation at what could be called the worker level, the people who actually put the details of proposals together and can collaborate on that. That's a place where things can become very focused, but in which you need to have the ability for lots of people to participate. It isn't necessarily true that everybody participates in one great big committee. Those are not very efficient. But you can have spontaneous aggregations of cohesive groups to formulate proposals, and then they can be promulgated up, possibly being integrated. In working group C, we've seen an enormous amount of inefficiency. We've seen an enormous amount of disagreement. And yet there's been pieces of process, some of it being, I think, facilitated by deadlines. A good rule in almost any organization is create deadlines for whatever reason you can, and things will get done. And we've seen that just recently, what appear to be wholly unreconciled differences, in fact, have a lot of overlap. Now, we haven't gone the next step to try to integrate them further, but I actually believe in the last week, some work that's going on in that mailing list, looks like that right kind of process. That's a completely open process. Pretty much anybody who wants to be there can. And so at that level, down at the worker level where the input counts, keeping that very highly open means that by the time ICANN makes a decision on this stuff, their choices are going to be constrained because the input they've got will have filtered up to a level. There'll be a degree of review and embracing or dispute about it. And so most of the real arguing will be done, and ICANN's job will not be to formulate proposals but to select among them.
I guess John Zittrain, who is my puppeteer, just passed me a note here and suggested that I call cold call in the verbiage of law school professors. Ken Coutier.
Oh.
Ken Coutier. Is Ken Coutier here? Ken, step up to the microphone. And a journalist, tell us what you want.
He wants no access to information.
It's actually an apropos question. It's kind of funny because I was talking to someone.
Speak right in on my.
Sure. Someone was mentioning how there was a letter sent from the European Commission to ICANN, and I think it was Tony Radakowski who posed the question previously. Would it be possible to post that online? Can we see it? When can we? Who would do that? Would the EC make it publicly available at ICANN? And I was joking, saying, well, it's sort of like the OECD, which is a large governmental organization in Paris, 29 countries, where it's actually my bread and butter to get leaked copies of the documents, to obtain it however I can, so that I can then publish it and have my readers and editors think that this is amazingly interesting and I'm a great reporter, but of course it's really incredibly anodyne that they're talking about. No one would love it.
Anodyne, is that like a technical word?
Oh, extremely boring.
Boring.
Yeah. And you wouldn't actually want to read it if you could. And the only reason I'm reporting about it, this work in process, is because there's a cachet because it's actually closed. Right now.
In other words, openness would kill your business.
Let's put it this way. I wouldn't get a raise. Yeah. the fact is, I make a great living of taking people who try to close information, and I try to open it up because I think at the end of the day there's a value that better decisions are made when they're made with more information and less information, that greater introspection, greater details aids the public policy process, or at least it's just makes for a really good news story. I would think that right now ICANN is getting off scot easy. You've got a handful of reporters, maybe four or five, mostly from the trade press, is following it. Jerry Falls in the New York Times, now coming in moving closely. In about 4 or 5 years, if all goes right, you're going to have a huge international press pool here who are going to be racing after stories, and they can't screw things up like they have before. They can't first say that they're going to have closed meetings and then say, oh, well, I guess we really should open it up when there's congressional oversight. They're going to have to understand that whether they're going to choose transparency or translucency, and I think that there's something to be said about closed meetings, obviously, because in certain circumstances, because not everything should be open, or these people shouldn't have a microscope in front of their lives. At the end of the day, there's going to have to be a great deal more attention paid to what they make open rather than closed, and they're not getting the same heat as they will in the future. And finally, most importantly, they should probably make the assumption that everything is open, and then what do we close and work in that direction.
So, just pursue it for me. I'm the director. I'm email correspondence back and forth before the meeting next month. Does that email correspondence have to be open?
I think I'm a reporter. Yeah, what am I going to say? Of course it is. ultimately, I take what I do seriously. I want to be a safeguarding, a guardian of democracy, and I think that the U.S. has a great model of the FOIA request. Something like that adds heat to officials, knowing that there is a degree of accountability, and there is a degree of scrutiny to what they do. I think that's very valuable.
Tamar, can I come to you?
Yes.
Tamar, my email, which this gentleman says has to be open, well, I suspect you would say not, but would you at least say that it has to be open sometime, that it is historically related to this ICANN venture, and at some point it should be part of the archives that open up to the public?
I think so.
When? How long?
The point is also, I would not prevent, to some extent it's a question of self-allocation, of course. Should you give Ken all the information before he even asks for it, or should he ask for it like the Freedom of Information Act? And then you ask for it, and then there are some things that are sheltered even from his eyes. Yes? I think that the model of the Freedom of Information Act is applicable to your email if it is not totally private.
So, Drake, what do you think here? They like our FOIA, our FOIA model. Our FOIA model is your email stays private until he puts in an FOIA request. And then some bureaucracy goes to work and looks through all your emails. You can do it yourself, maybe, but hey, you've got a lot of emails. And this guy's asking for everything because they write on the big broad request. So what we're looking at is some agency help that's going to go through your email and say, they get this, they don't get this, we'll give them this, but not this paragraph, which will black through there.
I don't think that's workable. You either have it one way or the other, and if I can't decide, who else can I trust to decide what should be public and what not? I think it gets back to the way that boards operate as I see it, and I sit on a number of them. People come, and in particularly in the case such as ICANN, after having observed and participated in a fairly extensive public debate about an issue. They come together and they exchange views in a meeting, and as you'll have observed, I think we've always reached a consensus. That doesn't mean that people didn't come into the meeting with contrary views, but in discussion with people that have as the interest of the internet at stake as much as you do, you listen to what they say, and I really mean listen. and minds can be changed in a way which is rather more difficult if you feel that you're trying to represent a constituency, demonstrate that you're you're holding to your view. Much more difficult to operate and achieve a consensus or even unanimity in the board under those circumstances.
So, with your email, Greg, do you see, when you're sending stuff around to board members and we're in the formative part of ICANN, and who knows what the future brings, this may be, you know, like the Federalist Papers, your email, do you think of your archive as historical, and when could you imagine it coming open?
Well, I think anyone would sensibly expect that their email is not private, and they would not say anything that they felt might expose them to ridicule or litigation. Apart from that, I don't mind anyone knowing my views at any time.
So you wouldn't mind if your email was just up there?
No, well, most of it is. I think it goes out to the ICANN board and everyone sees it.
Right?
But all right. The question of who wants to read all that rubbish.
Can I solicit questions from the audience on the subject, please? Come forward.
There's one issue that hasn't really been discussed. It's perhaps implicit in this, but I'd like to focus on it separately, and that is the possibility of conflict of interest in the future in ICANN as it becomes more and more a matter of directors that are selected from different countries, etc. There were many cases in the Cold War, for example, when people from Soviet bloc countries were being blackmailed. We know of these cases. There are cases today, I won't name the countries, but there are cases now where we're finding people being essentially blackmailed or influenced by the fact that they had family members in some country where there was a repressive regime, etc. There are also cases, obviously, of people simply being bought. And these kind of cases, have always been a problem. They were a problem when the U.S. Did its trust busting. In the history of American reform, there is the book, college textbook, there is an excellent analysis of how the boards that were set up to regulate the industries, in fact, became staffed by people who were essentially appointed by the very industries that they were expected to regulate. And in many cases, these industries were given great favors as a consequence.
So
the bottom line is, how do you prevent this? And I was going to, you know, just throw out one suggestion. It may not be practical, it may not be worthwhile, but I'm wondering what other ones there are. Suppose ICANN were to either set up a watchdog committee of some kind and deal with this, or, of course, the watchdog committee is going to be bought, open it up to the public, and perhaps offer a reward. Offer a $10 million reward for anyone who can prove that a director of ICANN was involved in a conflict of interest in making a decision about Internet policy.
I got myself in straight away.
And there's something like this to give everyone in the world a stake in finding, you know, we know how good these governmental bodies are at regulating themselves, who guards the guards, etc. But to give everybody in the world a stake, all the paranoid conspiracy freaks and everything, in finding something wrong. So you're always under the impression that you're
kind of a bounty.
Yeah, a bounty.
Put a bounty on these people. Good. Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me, I want to recommend that to the extent that recommendation is pursued, we need a counterbalancing force so we're not spending they're not spending all of their time defending themselves. Consequently, there needs to be an equal and opposite bounty against false claims.
Actually, I think this goes back to what you started out with and what we talked about a little bit earlier. There are some circumstances where we're entitled to know a lot about you, such as the existence of other interests that affect your ability to operate vis-a-vis ICANN. Now, my guess is you're not going to disclose the facts that are causing a governmental agency to blackmail you. But we may find a lot of other things that are important and valuable, and that sort of disclosure, I think, is important for ICANN.
There is some danger in this approach, and we also recognize that people can settle all sorts of other accounts through these types of false arguments or information. So I'm not sure that perhaps simply information plus some independent group of retired judges or people who can be trusted shouldn't take that over or shouldn't focus on this.
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you. My name is Teresa Amato, and I don't really see very many openness advocates on the panel here, but I want to start by pointing out a couple of factual inaccuracies. You wouldn't get in trouble for going to dinner with Mr. Crew. And it's only a question when you start talking about a public body's business, and usually it's with the majority of the forum of that particular public body that you get in trouble. But belonging to the same church or the same PTA doesn't get you in trouble with respect to the open government laws.
But if I was to sit down with Greg and we would talk about membership, which is clearly the key issue in front of ICANN, and we were to do that at dinner, that would be a problem.
If you were a significant portion of the decision-making group, perhaps.
Well,
but,
aha.
Correct. Correct. And all the arguments I've heard to date have been, the kinds of arguments that all governments traditionally have put forward for why they should be closed and not subject to public scrutiny. And I'd like to say that we don't have an unmitigated disaster in the United States of America, where virtually every public body is subject to the open meetings laws and to the Freedom of Information Act. And to the contrary, you have public confidence in how those procedures will regulate the decision-making process and allow the public and the people who are subject to those decisions to have a good understanding of how those decisions were arrived at and to feel confident in their decision makers. The question here is, you have bylaws with ICANN that would indicate a presumption of transparency, not translucency, transparency, and there are no specific guidelines for when those meetings should be closed. So if you were writing more specific guidelines for the bylaws, under what circumstances would you close the ICANN meetings? And shouldn't all the rest be open, and shouldn't every document that comes into ICANN, and if Mr. Crew's amenable to posting all his email for the public regarding the subject, shouldn't all of that be public?
Very well stated. Very well stated. Let's have response. Greg, what would you say?
In some cultures, it's actually entirely expected that going to the toilet is something that's done in public. But there's a social contract that no one will care. So it's something that's visible, but it's respected. What I believe is a tone of the default, let's make everything open, is a lack of the balance of what comes with that, which is a sense of proportion about the reasons people want things open and what they want open. So what you've been, I think, the tone to many of your questions has been everything should be open and then we're going to defend why something should be closed, rather than trying to understand what needs to be open and why.
Last question.
My name is Jim Bass and I'm with Bell Atlantic. I'll have to ask the question that's shorter than the answers. In terms of email, especially in terms of email exploder lists, I belong to U.S. Telecommunication Standards Group that maintains a lot of open lists but also has some closed lists. And in terms of openness and transparency, what are your thoughts about closed email exploder lists?
Great.
I think that they certainly serve a purpose, that quite often the group may wish to discuss a subject in order to try to, you know, achieve a consensus between them in a closed manner without throwing it open to public debate before they've got a specific issue to put for a resolution. And it may be better to do that in a closed list before going public with it than to be public right from the start.
So Greg, help us finish this off. Give us a narrative sense. You've been with this right from the beginning. You saw it at its closed point. You saw the pressures for openness. Give us a dynamic, a flow, not just a point picture, but a sense of where the process is going. Where do you see the open process, the transparency dictate upon ICANN going at this point?
I think it's probably heading towards more openness, if you like. The only area that is not open is, or has not been open, is that of the board meetings. And for the reasons that I mentioned, a number of directors believe that a closed board meeting was more effective and efficient. We went to an open meeting in Santiago. By then, of course, we'd got to know each other pretty well, and I think that went fairly well as a result. If you look at the way ICANN will be working, the critical issues are questions of policy. They are not formulated by the board, they're formulated within the debating groups of the supporting organisations, and I believe among the at-large constituency as well. There will be public comment before the board makes any sort of a decision, and the board has to make a decision based on, or is required to, all the directors are required to act in the interest of all of the constituencies, not on any particular one of them. That may be a little different in the political environment that we all, a lot of us know, in which there tend to be different policies advocated, and you elect your candidate on the basis of the policies you favour, and you expect to see them advocating those policies in the chamber, in the House. That's not quite the case one would expect to see in the board of a corporation like ICANN. But nevertheless, I see, yes, that more openness at the board level, and I don't believe that there's closed activities anywhere else in ICANN that I'm aware of anyway.
All right. Tamar, thank you very much for joining us from a distance. Thank you, members of the panel, for engaging in this discussion.
Thank you.
Join me in thanking the panel.
It's going to take, I think, literally 2 minutes as we just get our next panel up and keep things going, assuming that our moderator is ready.
I mean, here are all these experts out there, and we have just been talking to do this job.
We also wanted to listen to what we were saying about it and get our views.
When Hans tried to find Brent David, he was jumped on
from the audience.
But it started to open up, and I think what's happening is that was very early on in the process.
if we are becoming more confident in what we're doing is going somewhere,
we'll get to ourselves.
If you ask any of them, they'll probably just. I just did a live lunch with the five floors. You may know it from Melbourne, I see. And he had a number of issues. He's got with the NSI, DOC, ICANN agreement. So I was able to, I'm very happy to do that. Anything I have a view on, I don't have a view on. Well, grab me any time you see me. I'll be floating around the place.
Good, Jeff.
Oh, no. Well, some of you, it's just the way you want to handle it, is it?
When? Friday. On Friday, the 5th of November.
Yeah. Summary ought to be in.
Okay.
Oh, wait.
Is that open to everybody?
This is probably the question of direct election.
It's open to anybody that wants to come.
That's the question of direct election. Good. I'm glad you're going.
I think we're ready to start our final panel of the day. So if at most you could find a seat and at least could stop talking, that would be helpful. I've also been asked to say that the Asia-Pacific TLD group will be meeting on Friday at 8:30. They're hoping that not everybody will leave after the ICANN meeting. Instead, stick around from 8:30 to 6 o'clock on Friday. There will be the APTLD meeting to which everyone is invited. As you may know by now, in addition to the Berkman Center, we have a co-host for the day. That's the Markle Foundation. Markle Foundation has not only been generous enough to pay for this meeting, but they have been instrumental in helping us shape it, the agenda, the speakers, the focus, and that has been most apparent on the panel you're about to hear, membership. It's something the Berkman Center was involved in quite early with the membership study that we did and the liaison we did with the Membership Advisory Committee, and it's something that Markle has identified as very important to them. Alan Davidson, if you could stop talking. Milton Mueller, if you could stop talking. Thank you. Yes, I reserve the right to single people. Yes, exactly. This is where it all comes home. Also, Alan Davidson, who was just reprimanded, is with the Center for Democracy and Technology, one of our co-sponsors. And in some ways, Leslie Harris, whom I am now just transitioning into an introduction of, bridges that gulf. She is the head of the advisory board for the Center for Democracy and Technology, and also a senior policy person, a consultant with the Markle Foundation. In another life, she was the senior legislative counsel to the ACLU. And she will be chairing our panel today on membership issues. And with that, why don't I turn it over to you? Thank you, and welcome.
I just want to say that I am not a graduate of the Charlie Nesson School of Moderation, so whether or not I can pull off this walking back and forward and looking blasé, I really am not at all sure, particularly since these are made for men. This fits on your tie. and this fits in your coat pocket. This panel today, I think, is the one that sort of brings together in many ways all the issues that we've been talking about all day, and this is the at-large membership, the supposed opportunity for all of us in the unwashed masses of the internet community to participate in the ICANN process. I want to start off by letting the panelists introduce themselves. I'm going to turn it over to Greg Crewe briefly to describe what the bylaws currently say about how we are to conduct, to the extent they say anything at this point. We do have a structure now, this at-large election, and many of you may not know, but the board did have a conference call. When was this? Talk about transparency. When was it?
2 weeks.
Sometime in the last couple of weeks, and did adopt the bylaws on the at-large membership. And I'll have Greg describe that, and then I'm going to pose a couple of broad questions before we narrow down into more specific areas. I think we have sort of a twofold mission. One is that it looks like we actually do have a structure now, and so there are a lot of hard questions about what we need to accomplish in order to make this election work. At the same time, a lot of the criticisms of this proposed election process remain, and we have to figure out how we deal with those in the context of a process that now, at least in some way, is writ in stone. Why don't we go down and introduce ourselves, and Greg, I'll come back to you to describe the process.
Greg Crewe, Director of ICANN.
Editor of Reason Magazine and author and general writer about dynamic open systems, of which we hope this is one.
Izumi Aizu, Secretary General of the APIA Asia Pacific Internet Association, involved with IFWC and ICANN, and a member of MAC, used to be.
I'm Kent Graham. I'm a corporate partner with O'Melveny Myers and Sullivan's law firm.
Stephen Hill. I'm the Western Regional Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. We're a nonprofit organization that specializes in issues of democratic process, voting systems, representation, and I'm also the co-author of a book called Reflecting All of Us.
Teresa Amato. I'm the director of a nonprofit organization called Civic Commitment Advocacy Center, and I'm also here on behalf of the Consumer Club of
Thanks, Teresa. Greg?
I'm always here.
You're my peripheral vision.
I'm Diane Campbell again, but I'm here also because I was involved in the representation in cyberspace study that listed a number of the early issues and the MAC.
And in terms of folks on the panel who were members of the MAC, the Membership Advisory Committee, Greg, you were on the... Okay. Anybody else? Because I will come back at some point and ask sort of why on a number of points. Greg, can you give us a brief overview of what this structure looks like and what we're getting to vote for?
Yes, Leslie. This is the last, I guess, remaining major action that the board has to put in place, the sitting of the at-large directors to replace the initial directors. And I can assure you that all of the initial directors are looking forward to that. It's taking rather longer than we had hoped it might for a number of reasons. There has been extensive discussion in the management, in the Membership Advisory Committee, in public fora and so forth. We had some concerns which needed some legal resolution before we could make some final decisions on the bylaws, and this was some of these were cleaned up in Santiago. The executive staff then drafted a set of membership bylaws for Article 2, and we were able to agree on those in the last 2 weeks, I think it was, so that we do have the bylaws set in place to establish a membership to elect an at-large council. The bylaws contain most of the recommendations of the MAC. They have not gone forward with the original idea of directly electing the at-large directors for reasons which have been well discussed, in which the MAC was also concerned about. They contain comments about a reasonable constituency before we start the election of the council, They allow for a phasing in both of the council and the board members to give some testing of the process and also a sort of a phasing in and out of the older, of the initial directors and the new at-large directors. The key issues remaining for us, I think, are that there is still a lot of detail that needs to be put in place to establish a process and supporting systems to enable and a very large global online registration of members and a voting system to occur.
And we have how much money?
We have no money for that purpose at the moment, but we have our fingers crossed on that. But that was one of the reasons why, despite the MAC's wish that membership be open to everyone and there should be no inhibiting factors, including fees, it's not unreasonable that the at-large constituency pays for its own costs, as the supporting organisations have to pay for their own costs, and unreasonable that supporting organisations should pay for the at-large. So the bylaws require that they should be primarily self-funding. I think they're the key points at where we are. I just would like to just make one final comment. The bylaws as written contain some specific requirements, and they also have some specific prohibitions, but where they are silent, it doesn't mean it's a prohibition. It means it is possible or allowable. And there has been some commentary that this wasn't said, therefore they're excluding it. That's not the case at all. If it's not said, it's
so you've created another lawyer's relief act, and they'll all take advantage of that. Let me ask a broader question here, because I mean, I think a lot of you were here this morning. We sort of had a conversation about sort of what ICANN's mission is, and you know whether or not it's in fact engaged in policy, or whether it was in narrow decision making. It seems to me there's some tension between ICANN's view of its role, which is narrow, technical, managerial, and the desire to build a robust worldwide constituency. I mean, if this is really all that boring and unimportant to the rest of us, why would somebody vote? Why would you become engaged? I mean, I think that I have some concern figuring out how you have it both ways. How do we build something on this and at the same time continue to keep ICANN's mission within its bounds? Virginia?
Well, I think that is a temptation. The at-large membership presents an interesting dilemma because these members have many interests beyond their role in life as internet users. And in fact, their internet user life is probably among the least important aspects of their life. And so therefore, unless they are also engaged in the internet as a matter of technical interest or business interest, they're not going to be terribly interested in an ICANN with limited power. And therefore, participation in at-large membership elections will be low. And I would sincerely hope that that is the result. That's my stance on what ICANN should be. I do think, regardless, you will see the emergence of slates because of the difficulty of ordinary people who aren't engaged in this full-time knowing enough to evaluate, so that some type of branding, I mean, in a political sense, something about it, a party, will emerge. Now, if it turns out to be the case that ICANN's power can be extended to making social policy, then we'll see interest based on business, ideology, religion, nationalism, whatever, you name it, who will find participation worthwhile and will enter, and they will dominate the at-large membership process and probably, you know, in some sense, hijack ICANN to particular purposes. I think that's an interesting, there is a tension there.
Well, Teresa, let me see if you can answer this one for me, because if on the one hand we have a narrow technical mission, we're going to have a low turnout because these things are not of concern to most internet users, First of all, I want to hear what you have to say about that. But secondly, then why has ICANN, and I guess I have to go back to the MAX members, why has ICANN decided to define the relevant membership here in the broadest possible terms as pretty much all Internet users within a verifiable address? Why shouldn't it just be remaining?
We considered, well, the other option was, what basis would you have for discrimination? And the primary one was domain names. But people with domain names don't have a lot to do with protocol decisions. Protocol decisions can very well affect a lot of personal rights that you and I take for granted as citizens of the United States. So our interest is broader than domain names. And that's why we opted for the larger definition of the membership.
Well, I continue to hear sort of the cross messages as to whether or not what ICANN is doing affects something beyond narrow technical purposes. Teresa, I know that you were one of the most thoughtful critics on this direct versus indirect, so you must believe there's something at stake here that we're having to deal with.
Yes, I do. As currently written, I think there is a tension, and you brought it up this morning, and I think the panel that followed on privacy indicated that. Mr. Shapiro was talking about the kinds of decisions that ICANN would inevitably be in the middle of, and I think that in the future, ICANN is going to feel pressure from a variety of stakeholders to make those kinds of decisions, even if right now it has a narrow technical mission. However, given its narrow technical mission, it does have four guiding principles, not just stability and competition, but also bottom-up representation and coordination and representation. And given those guiding principles, I think ICANN should be in the position of trying to attract a large constituency and not in the position of trying to give everyone as many disincentives as possible to be a member of this organization. Right now I would ask, why would I want to be a member of ICANN? You have diminished rights, you're not at the table, you're invited into the process 2 years after the decisions have been made, and you don't have any of the natural statutory rights under California law. So why would I want to be a member of this organization given the package that's presented and how it's constituted right now?
Anybody, Diane, you want to
why you vote for president?
You get to vote for the director, you get to choose the term. You're just wondering why they choose the term. I don't know.
But Diane, isn't there a distinction? I mean, as much as a lot of us can't figure out what the purpose is of having an electoral college, we at least know who it is in the electoral college. You know, we know that there are two choices or three choices, and we pretty much know that when we're voting to six members of that electoral college, that they are bound to do a particular thing. We don't have anything that resembles that here. We're electing a council that then can go off and, I guess, elect themselves to the board, because I think it's sort of part of what type of a people are doing.
Ben, could you try to show the picture I gave you? Before going to this direct and indirect model, I'd like to just point out one sort of fact, if you can see. Because we've been trying to push so-called geographic diversity, and geographic diversity doesn't really mean only the geography. It could be economic or some other interest contained. And I tried to pick up how many users are out there in the world. Because this large membership is primarily either the end user or the internet users are the constituency, right? As opposed to their source. On the left column, you see it's the per population penetration, say 37% of the people in North America are defined as internet user. Could you show it to the next picture? That gives you a better idea. This is a real number of users. North America has more than 100 million, Europe 37, Asia 33. Quite a lot. But if you go another picture, the third one.
And your last picture.
Yeah. This is a percentage base. In Asia, only less than 1% are using the net, while in North America, 37. So it shows, on the one hand, what is at stake could be very different, or in the larger sense of social policy or societal.
But isn't that just right now?
It is.
Defining what's at stake.
Right. Well, I should make it a sort of animation or moving one, but still, how long does it take for the Asians to, if you include China and India, to reach 37%? 10 years?
Well,
20?
Okay,
30?
So what's the point? Right now, this is only a concern to North America. You've been following this around the world as far as the that's
what you're saying. Well, do we have a uniform or issues at large membership to discuss? Or could be, this issue itself could be very diverse. What kind of mechanism to address this diversity is a very interesting challenge.
Well, I think it's a challenge in creating the constituency at all. Is what do we have in common? And if Virginia's right and these were, a fairly narrow set of issues, then even a smaller number of us had that in common. We are not the trademark lawyers who know exactly what we're doing for ICANN. It's a different dynamic.
I think these figures point out an extreme, to me, disturbing aspect of the way of the membership in the at-large council is defined, which is that it is designed to discriminate against populous countries that have high internet penetration, that is to say, against most of the voters who are voting.
Because there's more of us because, still a geographic
because
reason.
There will be, because it's based on, not on they geography, but on the nation state.
Actually,
so that, for example, Europe is not treated the same as North America. Europe is treated as a geographical place in many different countries. A neutral geographical distribution would be based on something like time zones or latitude, or something that was not as Paul said earlier on the earlier panel. I thought it was very uncosmopolitan to have your country code your most significant bit, and yet that has been enshrined in the at-large membership. Okay.
And there's also a question of whether
it's truly representative to have something that looks like at least as unbalanced as the U.S. Senate in terms of the population of netizens versus the voting population.
Well, I mean, I think it raises a larger question, and I had a conversation with Stephen earlier where he said, the election structure is like the operating structure of your computer, and I guess, what you were saying is sort of, architecture is destiny, and that, my question is both what do you think of the structure, but was the structure in fact created to come out a particular way when we have an election? I don't know, but what you're saying to me is, every way you set it up, whether it's direct or indirect, or how you break up the geographic, is going to make a difference on whether it's ultimately representative or proportional. Did I understand that right?
Right. The basic message is that how you elect in terms of voting systems, whether you're using something like cumulative voting, which a lot of corporations use to elect their board of directors, or you're using something like choice voting, which is a proportion representation system, or just a plurality system, highest vote getter wins. It really is like the operating system of your organization in terms of deciding who's going to get elected to that board. And that, as far as I can see, has not been defined, though there was a recommendation by the membership advisory committee to use proportional representation, but I couldn't tell in reading the documentation whether that was just a broad statement, as we heard consensus this morning, sort of was just a broad fuzzy term. Is proportional representation in this context a broad fuzzy term, or do you really mean use a proportional representation voting system which would give you the broadest, most diverse representation on that board? A couple of other points that I noticed about your structure that, as I guess it's been cast, half of the board is support organizations who are by nature better organized, more financed, are going to essentially, by giving them half, you're saying half the board is going to probably be better organized than the other half. Okay. The other half is split among political ideology, national ideology, all sorts of other things, whether they can ever come up with a coherent platform program if they're going to push as an at-large representatives, that a much different, a more difficult challenge for them than for the others who are basically market-driven, commercial-driven organizations who pretty much know what their bottom line is, okay? The third thing is that the elected council is kind of like the Electoral College of the United States, the handout that I had handed out, if there was time to go through a demonstration, I could show you that it's going to lead to a reduction of representation by having this two-tiered system. And again, it's a matter of the structure, the architecture that you're putting together here. It doesn't matter what the intention was, that's what it's going to lead to. And the fourth thing is that the fact that apparently the at-large, you need 5,000 or more in order to be to have it be a coherent election. I mean, I sort of think of what if we required the United States for a majority to turn out for our elections before they actually were valid elections. We would never have an election that was valid. And you're not requiring that for the supporting organizations to have some sort of threshold. So some distinctions are being made here that, in my view, and I come at this from, you know, purely from a sort of new to this whole ICANN stuff, which is looking at the structure there and the point of view of democracy. I see that the hand, one hand of the at-large membership is sort of being tied behind their back in terms of having input, having say over what this organization is going to be able to do.
Ken, you're also an expert.
Yeah, I come at this really late. I was added to this panel late Friday afternoon, so I have the benefit of not having listened to all the rhetoric in the past, although I have read some of it, and that's obviously a disadvantage for me, too. I sit here as a corporate lawyer trying to imagine how in the world any of this is going to work in the real world and know for a moral certainty that it will not result in a good board of directors being put in place, which I think if you step way back from it, the question is what are you really trying to accomplish here? Is it to elect a quality board that represents philosophically and otherwise the geographic and other interests in that community, or is it to let anybody who was born kind of have a shot at the board? And I think you really have a very tough situation here in terms of getting a board that makes any sense at all and that isn't going to be paralyzed by the balkanism that's inherent in what you've got here.
Well, I mean, I think you raised the question that I wanted to get to, and I do want to spend some time talking about, okay, we're here, we've got it, what do we need to do separately, but what was the vision of those who were involved in putting ICANN together in having an at-large membership at all? If Virginia is right and these are narrow and arcane and technical issues and most people are going to be bored even if they use the internet, was it in fact, to provide the checks, the checks and balances, by having a set of a consensus model and a set of people who come in who are not sort of part of the different industry structures that they could just not provide consensus and so they don't need a formal checks and balances? Was it that they were going to participate sort of fully in this? Are they window dressing? Why are they here? Because I think I'm not sure that those of us who may go out and organize this constituency are completely clear about what our role may well be. So, Greg, Diane, Daniel.
Perhaps I make a comment. What is ICANN in existence for?
Well,
the way
what
I express
it's not.
It.
I don't know if you want to get that piece in
it. Well, no, except that ICANN exists to create a mechanism whereby the internet community can come together and develop policy for the orderly growth and development of the internet. And as you say, the supporting organizations provide commercial and technical interests, which are going to be the major source of information and know-how to do that. But you need to balance that by the needs of the community that are using the internet and maybe one day will use the internet if they're not using it now. And the purpose of the at-large constituency and the at-large directors is to provide that balance against the knowledge and the expertise of the people who are involved in developing, running, selling the internet services, and those who are involved in using it and wanting it to go in certain ways. So I think it's not a government body. It's not attempting to provide any form of governance, if you like, of the world community or the It is essentially to provide a forum for the groups of interest in where the internet is going to come together and formulate policy.
And see, I mean, I sit here and I think, okay, you know, 9 people without all that technical inside baseball sit in a room with, you know, whatever number it is, the people who do. You know, just in terms of the deliberative process, Steve, I mean,
well,
are we being serious here?
The thing that comes to mind as I listen to Greg talk is the intention, and but then the structure that we put in place, and is that going to achieve what was intended? By putting in this sort of electoral college mode, where you sort of remove it, what, I mean, I detect, besides the intention that was there, was a bit of suspicion that somehow we want the masses out there to be involved with the ballot, but we don't want them quite too close. That and in fact, you know, if we don't have time to go through this demonstration, but I can show you that even if you use like a proportional representation system for the first round, which I haven't heard of commitment to quite yet, the second round, the majority that still is elected to that council could easily put in all their people onto the board. And so you basically end up, because of this two-tier structure, with a very narrowing of the field of the types of points of view that are represented here. And so I'm seeing a gap between the intention and the system that's supposed to deliver what you've intended.
So what you're saying is you get this council and then they could very well put in people whose views or interests were completely consistent with the...
Right, because what I think I saw somewhere is that everyone who's elected from the council to the board is going to need a majority of the council to elect them to the board.
Right.
And so when you use a majority threshold like that, it means the people who get passed through that threshold are people who basically go along with the majority. And so the people who get shut out are the people who don't go along with the majority. And so when you filter it down, each level you filter it down, you make it narrower and narrower. So you filtered it twice, and you may be using proportional representation. You may not. If you use some sort of plurality, highest vote getter wins every step of the way, by the time you get to the end, you don't have much left in terms of representation.
And you don't have John Q. Internet sitting
right
up there. Teresa and then Kent, I saw you both.
I think the system is perfectly designed, consistent with the intention of not having individual users represented at all in the decision-making process. I think the structure reflects that perfectly, because you have a situation where you're not going to attract people to be involved, and if you ever dip below 5,000, you're not going to have any right to exist anyway. There's no similar, the corollary to what's said right here is that once you have 5,000 place, if assuming you ever get to that position and given this incentive structure to become a member, people will be able to dissolve the entire membership side. Lots of those members will be able to dissolve the membership side by just leaving and saying we no longer want to be a member, and therefore the entire that half will dissolve. You don't have a similar. You know, and there's been much emphasis on why we need to have an at-large council to have parity with the supporting organizations, but you don't have similar requirements in the supporting organizations, and if only 3 or 4 supporting organizations show up, their path to the board doesn't dissolve.
The frustrating part of this for me is that it all presupposes that because you get elected, you're going to be an effective director. And those of us who have spent our lives dealing with boards see how difficult it is, even when you have 1 or 2 people on a board who really don't get it, who don't understand how to be a director. It takes several years for somebody to be really an effective, accomplished director in any context. And I would think that the process, all of these problems are the reason that the way boards are typically put together is to try to identify what the key constituencies are that you need to have represented on the board and go find the best people you can to fill those slots. If there is openness and if there is a standard of I want high quality people and I want this to pass the smell test with glowing colors, that kind of a board could easily be put together with individual members, whatever the right mix is. Doing it this way is not going to end up with the best people. And as a result, it's going to harm the corporation. And at the end of the day, what are we worried about here? Is it the corporation, or is it a bunch of different constituencies?
Well, I mean, I think that leads into, Joe, you have a question. Stand up, identify yourself. No special privilege.
I would just like to hear some back and forth on that question, which is that they have now approved these bylaws.
That's where I was headed.
And
we got it now. We now have this. So,
they have had to go through a process of thinking through and say, we have approved this because we think it will achieve some fairness and representation.
Well, I don't know the why, because I haven't seen any public articulation of the why. Well, I don't know. Greg, are you the Diane? I mean, were you on that call?
I can give you why I wanted to see.
Okay.
And the reason I got engaged in the first place was because, I represented clients who were domain holders who had no say in how their personal rights to use this are going to be treated. And that voice, that person who isn't on the technical structure, who isn't part of the old boy network, is affected by some of these decisions, not all of them, but some of them. And I don't live in California. So they don't represent me, and they don't represent the guy that lives in Belgium either. So these people are affected just the same, and I think they should have a voice somewhere.
But isn't Kent saying we set this thing up so that we can't guarantee we're going to get an effective voice?
You have no idea what you're going to get.
You may not even get people representing them.
You have no idea what you're going to get.
Yeah. What you're going to get out of it. I mean,
and that's our Congress. you get what you put invest in.
Well, I mean that takes us to another whole issue. The invest in that takes us to the whole question of how we're going to conduct this election. Coming from Washington and just watching the debacle of the campaign finance. I mean, how are we going to conduct an election here where people know about this, people care about this? And what I keep thinking about, we have to, for now, at least for this election cycle, sort of all say, okay. This is, we're going to dance with the one that's from us, and it seems to be this kind of election structure. How are we going to do this? Should I go out and nominate Jerry Berman and start a PAC for my civil liberties plate and raise a lot of money? And, shall I, be a large telecommunications corporation and put together a plate of individuals and capture the election? Who's going to watch that? How are we going to decide this is representative? What are the actual decisions? I mean, we're sort of stuck between the fact that a lot of us don't like this very much. And let me just read, I did get one real-time comment. We are, after all, in cyberspace, from Dennis Schaefer. I'm very disappointed to learn that ICANN has abandoned the idea of direct selection in front of an at-large body. It seems to favor the capture of the council by trade associations, organized bodies that monitor ICANN activities as part of their professional life. Comments? I think it leads us into this whole conversation. What are we going to do now?
It sort of reminds me of some way, in Germany they have these supervisory boards that oversee corporations of 2,000 more employees, and half the stockholders are supposed to represent the employees, and the other half is supposed to represent the stockholders. And the way it works out in fact is that the deciding vote always votes for the stockholders. And so, you set up the system where half is going to the supporting organization, half are going to the at-large, but because of what you've been outlining, it'll be easy to set up slates and to put some money behind some of those slates so that some of the stakeholders on the support organization side could easily win a few of the seats on...
What can we put in place to prevent that?
Well, the best thing is, of course, representation.
Ah! I
think the last thing we want to prevent is the easy creation of slates.
By
Jerry Berman, his civil liberties plate, by, the Bell Atlantic slate. What you want is to have slates in the open and have people making as much fuss about who they are and why things are at stake.
So Bell Atlantic can have their slate that goes back to transparency, but should we
I mean,
I want to change funding rules so we know that Bell Atlantic is putting out their material in cyberspace as compared to Jerry's dollar donations from 50 cent donations from
Diane? Excuse me. They can go join the Dominion Network. I mean, that's where organizations are supposed to be on this side. I understand that there's not necessarily a one-to-one interest.
Well, what about your clients, the domain name holders?
They can't join that side. They have to be an organization to join that fund.
They're
the only place they can come is the
Membership. There are no those your clients are not any kind of organization.
No. And even if they were, they'd have to be an IT one or a commercial, a business entity, or a non-commercial. But me, I can't just myself if I don't have these things. If I don't want to join some club, there's no voice for me. And I'm really resistant to the idea that organizations can come over to the at-large and shove them aside
you're going to get what we have in California with slate mailers, where you elect judges based on complete ignorance. Unless you have some way of meaningful...
Well, we elect Congress based on...
No. This is an entirely different level of ignorance, but we have parties in election of Congress, and that's why they matter. I mean, that's why it's meaningful that you know somebody. I mean, maybe not as meaningful as you might like, but if you know somebody who's a Democrat or Republican, it helps you make a decision.
All right, so you're advocating that at a minimum, who's funding your slate, who's putting out materials for your slate, what the slate stands for, what do they care about?
Well, we're discussing Mac about that. Is it feasible, practical in a global system? How do you verify this individual doesn't belong to or not funded by this organization, things like that, in Africa or in Asia?
Well, I don't know how you enforce it. I mean, I shudder to think about setting up an enforcement
But if it's not implemented, it doesn't really have any meaning.
Well, indeed.
And so in reality, what I would see, we will see is, although we made a minimum, say, qualification, individuals, these can be the, employees of large organizations, small, whatever, and so that this at-large membership in reality will become another, say, battlefield, another competition for capturing each other. If you put it positively, that's the reality that we've been doing and will be doing.
But does that mean we've set up the same thing where we've got, we have the corporate constituencies have an interest here, and in many ways they're represented by the support organization, and we've now set up a system for the at-large membership, which will simply be the support organization creating slates, running. I mean, what can we put in place, knowing that we're in a situation where enforcement is going to be extremely difficult? We're going to be the indicia at the end of the day when we look at this election and say, captured or not captured, good or bad. Who's going to tell us that? And then I'm going to go to the question.
I think one of the concerns here is that you're really way out on the fringes here of anything that anybody's ever done.
I'm always way out on the fringes, but I assume you weren't talking to me.
No. At the start of an organization like this, with the kind of life that it has, getting too far outside the well-plowed ground. I mean, this is not a problem that anybody that I know has trouble solving. There's a way to do this. You don't do it in the context of a California nonprofit corporation by. I came across an interesting quote from the leading treatise on California corporation law written by the guy who wrote the statute. And this was the issue of access to membership lists is what he was talking about, would not arise frequently with respect to public benefit corporations, although membership fights have occurred where such organizations have foolishly given the legal status of members to large numbers of the public. These kinds of problems are not new to people. This issue has been litigated, it's been dealt with
right.
In the context of the California nonprofit, and you start getting out on the fringes at the beginning of this kind of an organization, you're going to make serious mistakes. You don't have to make those mistakes to get a good board in place.
Right, but assuming that what's been done thus far is a mistake, and I'll just take you care of
it. I'll take that a step further. There could be a way where the procedure that somebody decided to follow was that a slate would be put together, that would stand the smell test, you know,
right,
across the board, high quality slate, and put that slate out to the membership,
right,
for vote. That's a much, that process is much more likely to result in a feeling of a democratic process, a good board, and something that could be done before the next millennium than this. And
so,
I think that'd be very easy to put in place.
All right, so are you, what if you're suggesting that we go back to direct democracy here, but we propose slates? You're talking about in the context. I mean, I'm trying to deal with the context.
Yeah, the nomination process.
With the nomination.
The current board.
Ah.
Or a blue chip committee to say appoint.
Ah.
I mean, take your pick. My premise. My premise is that
it's your conference.
There is a group of people that have enough integrity and standing that can be selected that would be able to accomplish that kind of a selection. That's my basic premise, because it happens all the time.
It does, you're right. It's a very interesting statistic.
Kent, you have, as you said, the advantage and the disadvantage of being new to these wars, nobody would debate the proposition that a slate of qualified people could be chosen to run an organization like this, because it does happen all the time. But if it was chosen by somebody other than the people who think they want and have a right to choose it, they would view it as undemocratic, unrepresentative, not their slate of people. And that really is the heart of the problem that we face. Let me give just a minute of context here, because there's some confusion on how we got to where we are. The very first draft of bylaws of the organization that ultimately became ICANN proposed four supporting organizations, the three that we have, and a fourth called industry/users. And the three that we have were projected to have three directors from each of those for a total of nine, and the industry/users to have six directors for a total number of directors of 15. And the rationale for that was that this is basically a technical administrative organization, and so the people who are involved in the technical administrative part of the Internet ought to be the people who have the majority of influence. But it is an organization which will affect a lot of people, maybe everyone who runs the Internet, and so those people, whether they be businesses, small businesses, big businesses, individuals, whoever, ought to have a voice in how these policies are set forth. We got from there to here, which I agree is a very messy place to be. We got from there to here because of a very strong feeling on a part of the stakeholder group that we needed to have more involvement and more influence and more direct involvement and direct influence by the user community,
so,
as opposed to the technical administrative community.
So is this the no disease goes unpunished kind of problem?
Well, I don't think it's that, but we got from there, which is back in June of 98,
right,
to here, which is November of 99, having this argument.
Right.
Over and over and over and over again for 18 months. And we've gotten to where we are now almost by sort of a default, really. This group of unelected, undemocratic, unrepresentative board members feels like they have an obligation to try to put something in place that solves those problems. They've selected this device for all the reasons that have been laid out. It is a crummy device. It's a messy device. It's not a very attractive process at all. But they have been unable to find a better way to accomplish the multiple aims of the multiple collections of stakeholders that we're trying to complete.
So,
yeah.
How are we going to make this work? I mean, how are we going to make this work if this is what we got?
No, I think that is obviously a very serious question. I'll tell you what my personal view, and this is not the view of the board. I know Greg and I have talked about this, so I know it's not his view. My personal view is that the structure is wrong. That we shouldn't this we should go back toward the direction we were in when we started, not to have this be a representative democracy, but to have a process for input by users, but to have that come from probably from organizations of users, be they the Consumer Union, be they the Center for Democracy and Technology, be it whatever. Groups that are in existence to represent these interests, and to have those groups serve the same role that similar groups like the ICAA and the ICC and the IETF and the W3C, et cetera, serve in these other
constituencies. Certainly we're not on those, so there is something to be said. Steve and then Virginia.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. You can sort of hear what the corporate model is doing, how those things versus democracy. I'm reminded of what Winston Churchill once said, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. And so that, it seems to me, to be the key issue here. Is this the proper forum for democracy? And, you know, looking at, say, like the World Trade Organization, people thought that was not a proper forum for democracy. And yet we find that the World Trade Organization is making huge decisions that impact people's lives every day. So that may have been a forum where they decided that democracy wasn't necessary and maybe was a very poor choice. Here, in this situation, I'm reminded of another thing that I read here. I am also somewhat new to this, but that's my understanding that ICANN will oversee the root server of all domain names on the Internet. Is this correct?
Yeah.
Seems to me that's a pretty crucial, fundamental aspect of the Internet, and that the people who are putting these structures in place now, I have no doubt they have the best of intentions, but they may not be here in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. And it seems to me there's a tremendous commercial interest for someone to be in control of the root server. And so, you know, that to me lends itself to things like maybe there is a reason to have democracy involved in this situation, that this is not a proper forum for like a WTO type of structure. This is more a proper forum for something that on the order of
I'd actually like to step out of the role briefly. Right, exactly. And I speak as the director of the Berkman Center. The Berkman Center has been involved in this issue from the beginning, and really took on the member of the Berkman Center. We did it because we thought this was the key question in the most difficult process of course. Our conception of the problem I thought the original conception of ICANN came to John Sotel on the first name was actually quite beautiful. That is, as I see the whole problem of cyberspace, the major border in the space, the borders in the space. The number one border in the space is that between the open and the closed domain, proprietary and public domain. Our history has been that we've seen the Internet start as a balance, and then all of a sudden, huge capital goes into the proprietary domain. It has an enormous explosion on that side. But then here comes ICANN with the how to reify a system of choosing nine people. We actually have to choose nine people
who truly embrace the mission of the public domain. That's our problem. And every system that we played with here is, by my lights, subject to so easy capture. How much does it cost to buy a vote in a system where it's all by email and there's no real authentication? So here this flower that he wants to send off into cyberspace gets captured by the proprietary domain. Well, I'd like to offer a possible thought towards a different solution, a change of structure, just as Joe was suggesting. Right now it's choose 9 on one side, 9 on the other, and they together choose the president, making up 19. When I ask who do I trust to represent the public domain, and I think that we're making a legal entity of ICANN, this is a legal reality that we're creating, so we're in a legal world, that the members of that world are, on the one hand, the proprietary interests, the corporations, the for-profit corporations of the world, and on the other, they're the non-profits, the NGOs, all of the entities, the legal entities that are by their law committed to the public domain. And that strikes me as a possible base of membership. So if one were to think of the non-profit domain choosing 9, and then one were to look to the powers of democracy, the plebiscite, you actually want to embrace people, with the election of the president of ICANN, the balance. That seems to me to have elements in a direction that might ultimately preserve what we're looking for, which is an entity that actually balances the public and the private domain. So that's just a thought.
What are the powers of the president, John?
What are they? That's not the problem that I was asked to solve.
Before I go to your question, Kent, can we take the time to do that? I mean, if Charlie's right, can we take the time to do that? Do we have to have this election by April? Can we step back and decide whether that's a better structure? Can the board do this by order?
Yes, from what I see, any of this can be changed at this point. And that's one of my concerns, because once you get too far down this path, you can't change it.
Well, I think some people think we're there, and I don't know. Maybe
no, you could change this if you want to.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
I'm agnostic on this proposal, but it's not clear to me that limiting the at-large voting to certified nonprofits, which varies with the national law, among other things. We have nonprofits. I work for nonprofits. It's not an NGO in the UN sense, and I know people and. Sweden, who work for what would look like a nonprofit who are in the space, but it's not, I'm not sure that it would work, and I'm not sure that it addresses the problem of that, where this all came from, which is the sense that individuals want a voice. I still think they'll express that voice through something labeled, but to say that you must be a nonprofit to have standing, I think.
I'll be very brief. The piece that was missing is I went through all of the stuff that I went through this weekend, and I tried to read as much of the history of this as I could. It was that the debate was always about who are we going to give votes to, that whole process. I didn't see a word that said how do we select the very best directors to meet the vision that you described. I didn't see a word that said that. And that's the issue. Whether it's nonprofits or whether it's people selected by a plebiscite or whatever, that's the issue, and it simply does not appear in your literature. And if if you need to step back, it's to talk about that issue, and it may be a completely different configuration than you've got now.
Standards for
today? I'm new to this, and I apologize, but that was the piece. I'm the corporate governance expert.
Right.
That was the piece that was profoundly missing from anything I read, and I read a notebook full of stuff.
So my 8-year-old, who happens to have several email addresses, probably shouldn't want to. He could right now.
I wanted to second that. I think that's accurate, and I think Joe Sim said it this morning in terms of the number of hours that have been put into this process. Very few hours, even though relative to the other hours that have been put in dedicated to the membership. That's not to denigrate the membership advisory committee's efforts or the Berkman, but as Charlie said, it's a very complicated question, and the emphasis, at least from ICANN, in terms of top-down, you've got the timetables and sort of deadlines, this is what must be done, has not been on membership at all. It's been on creating the supporting organizations, and so we've been the poor stepchild of the process here, even though it was started very early on, the requisite number of hours necessary to grasp these issues and come up with a working process hasn't been done, and now we have this structure in place, and the thinking has not all been there. And we absolutely have to rethink the structure.
So you're saying better to put it off and do what? Let me stop for Kent, but my question is, and do what? I mean, what would we do differently as a community, those of us on the outside? What should they do differently on the inside so that we have some... So that we reach a result that people walk away from saying, okay, now we feel comfortable about having an election. I'm going to come back to that question, but Kent. Oh, Jerry, get up in line like everybody else.
I just wanted to bring up a concrete example of Jonathan Zittrain's great example in one of his commentaries, and just remind people of this. Time had this Man of the Year contest, and the winner in every category was a person named Mustafa Atatürk, who was a person famous in Turkish history, but not otherwise well known. And he was, much more famous as a scientist than Einstein, da-da-da-da-da. This is because Turkish patriots thought that it would be great if they could get this man elected as Man of the Year. Man of the Century. And the question of capture in an online environment like ICANN puts up is a really, really serious question. And it's one that it really does need a lot of thought, and I echo what these people are saying. But we really do need to go back and think about that.
If I could just say the other thing that another along those lines, everybody's worried about the commercial interest. But this is exactly what happens. I mean, go to the modern library best books, fiction and nonfiction of the past 100 years, and they're absolutely dominated by works either by or about or somehow related to L. Ron Hubbard or Ayn Rand.
Well, then maybe we shouldn't worry, since the internet community is full of conspiracy theorists. We might organize ourselves quite well.
Yes. Frankly, I'm totally confused. And that's why
I can't
imagine. Yes. One thing I did notice was that in all the times recently that I went on the ICANN sites, that I didn't see any big ads up there saying, join ICANN, you can vote on directors, or join ICANN, become a member, you can vote on things. There was, I looked around to see how you become a member, and I didn't have a whole lot of time, but I didn't find the directions as to how to become a member. So
it's because they don't exist yet.
They don't exist yet, and even then, you're a member in a certain sense, but not as you might.
There's another reason. Until you've got a system in place to capture member applications, there's no point asking.
It doesn't exist yet.
No, okay, well, that explains
they
that.
They can, but depending on,
yeah. I'm also confused. I think the big confusion here is what is ICANN? What is the Internet itself? I mean, what about people that aren't even on the Internet yet because they can't afford to be on the Internet, or the facilities aren't there, but they'll be on the Internet eventually. They would like to be on the Internet, and if they had a deciding voice somehow in ICANN, they might be able to facilitate decisions that would get them on the Internet sooner. Do they have any less rights than people that are on the Internet now?
Yep.
So essentially, I'm talking about the entire world population. And,
well, that is one of the reasons, or at least one of the theories between the non-commercial domain name sector, which is, at least in theory, the threat, which is that the organizations who represent the interests of the sort of unrepresented would join that. Now, that has only happened to this point, but I would think, at least in terms of that issue, there was a place that you could go. I think it's also sort of the reason we have this incredibly open idea of what a member is, but so, it doesn't mean those people are going to know, right?
Yeah, to follow up on that, though, there's a further complication that, obvious from that one, that not everybody has the same stake in the Internet. Some people use it very little. Some people it's very, some people it's totally invaluable to, or their life depends on it. Other people, you know, have very little stake in it. Yet, the proposals so far seem to give everybody the same vote in it, and the decision power in effective organizations seems to be more reflective of the actual stake in the property that's involved in the choices, which is the running of the Internet, deciding how it's going to be structured. So just as a thought, why not open up the discussion again, as people propose here, and think about forming a Internet trust. I hesitate to say corporation, but something like a corporation in which people can buy shares in it, in which everybody that gets a domain name, for example, automatically gets a share in the trust, and it's run as a profit-making organization for
all
the
right.
world.
Sit down. This is too much for us. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Almost, but we're gonna get to the two questions. I'm gonna go back to the panel to this question that I think, if I can remember what it is, the question I posed. If we were to stop now and say, you know, we can't figure out capture, we're not, you know, this is, what would we do differently? Let's say we just gave ourselves 3 more months or 6 more months. What would we do differently? And can't see, I mean, you obviously have some input here, but it's not gonna be valuable for us to have, you know, like we're in the hamster cage, we'd be going round and round and round. What are we going to do to get out of it that we could do in a concrete way between now and June that would produce a different result or a result that would feel legitimate in the eyes of enough stakeholders that we can move forward? Steve, Ken.
Yeah. Right. Well, if you have definitely decided that this is going to be a representative body and not the corporate model that Ken is saying, which, you know, there's virtues to both, but you've decided that this is going to be representative, then I would revisit the question of the 9 and 9 and whether the supporting organizations, I mean, what entitles them to 9 seats, to half the seats?
It's monopoly, you know, who owns Boardwalk and Park.
Well, I mean, that, and it seems to me that some of it has just been kind of by default that the supporting organizations, as we've heard, got more attention early on, and sort of like, I get the sense it was almost like, well, we'll give them half the seats. And there wasn't, maybe it wasn't as flip as that, but that's what I would like to know more about that. Why were they given half the seats? So I would revisit that and perhaps give them maybe a quarter of the seats or a third of the seats. Then the rest of them I would elect with some sort of at-large system using a proportional representation system like single transferable vote, which is candidate-based. It would give diverse representation to the at-large membership along ideological lines, racial lines, national lines, all these sorts of things, without having to necessarily assign seats by geographic area, though that might be something to preserve as some geographic representation. So basically, I would say revisit that question on the division of the 9 and 9, and then make sure you elect the at-large membership using some sort of proportional representation voting system, like single transferable vote, choice voting, or even cumulative voting.
Kent, you would like us to say what it is we want out of a director here?
Well, I would try to keep it real simple. I think your history here, I mean, it's a very complicated history, and again, I apologize because I'm coming to this so late. I would try to keep it real simple. I think I would try to get the board to articulate what it is they really think the rest of the board needs to look like to satisfy the constituencies that have a stake in this, from individual members to geographic representation. Exactly what does that slate need to look like? Make a commitment to receive nominations from anybody who wants to make a nomination, but to make it very clear that you're going to look for your own people. And to undertake a real intensive effort to find a slate of people that clearly meets, by all standards, the smell test. It may not be everybody's best slate, but it's going to be a pristine slate, and put that slate in place and see how people feel about it. I think if that were done with the right articulation of the vision, the right commitment to the important constituencies, it could be done. I don't know anything about the politics of your organization, but that could be done in most organizations at this stage.
Jerry, he missed kindergarten. He doesn't know anything about taking turns. Go ahead, Jerry.
No, I think that
there's a tricky argument for Charlie. If you're going to keep getting out of turn, you've got to at least
go from life. Half of the job, John Postel did half of the job, and there's the other piece of it, which is what to do with the unorganized and the user community and the rest of the potential users. He didn't get to that piece, or he didn't devote enough. One possibility to play on this is that you put together an interim board for that part of the internet, which is
using that slate,
which is to come up with a slate and not put them in for a long period of time, but a period of time to think through that issue
and make
recommendations back on how to institutionalize that in the same way that the first 9 did
in the current model. You would simply appoint the committee that is now to be elected. I mean, that would serve as a nominee.
All right, let me get these. I see that it's
almost
5. Let me get these questions. Yeah.
Okay, this is Gilliam John. This is a question beyond next June. Suppose everything goes well. Okay, we have a member and a members council and a board member. And what's the right and obligation of those at-large members, what you may call the nepotism? They can vote. What else? I mean, are they the watchdog of say support organizations, or I can vote, or are they going to impose something? Of course, they can join DNS or AS or PSO if they have a specific interest. But in general, as a netizen, what's their obligation and the right? The reason why I'm asking is that we have to now go through the membership drive, and then we can tell them, oh, you may have to pay some money, not now, but later, and you can vote. I mean, is that all I'm supposed to do? No.
You should answer this, because you talk a lot about members.
Yeah, this I know. People are concentrating on the election. We have to do well, but we have to think about next to have a good membership drive.
I think if you're
in an
extremely difficult position of making it attractive to belong to this organization and have a membership drive when you don't have rights to contest elections, to remove directors, to access the membership list, to amend the bylaws, to bring a derivative action, any of the kinds of stakeholder rights or member rights that you would have with statutory membership under the state of California law, what do you get in this process? To be a member, you get to vote for folks on an at-large council and have a very diluted voice, and you get to pay for that privilege.
Well, you could easily put together a package of things they get. I mean, people join organizations all the time and don't give a thought to having those other rights.
Right.
They're getting something else for it. They are a member of the organization. They may get a newsletter that other people don't get. There are all kinds of things that you could make.
They care about the mission. They have somebody who's doing it. The Zuni.
Yeah, Kim and myself and YJ Park have been visiting 5 cities in Asia to actually trying to reach out, not only for the class membership, but for the PLD groups. So we went to Bangkok, Seoul, Taipei, Beijing, da 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 da. Okay. We have a similar question. The most effective way to raise their awareness, or interest, involvement is negative approach. If you don't participate, you'll be left out, or you get some, you know, unfavorable decision by the Americans or Europeans or whatever.
Right, but what?
And that's very unfortunate, but it's been the truth.
So
and sometimes it works pretty well.
Who do we get to organize again?
The French.
When in doubt.
But it's not only the Asians, but the Americans also. Well, not only us, but you guys as well.
Everybody
is always trying to bring this negative approach that you are afraid of the capturing by some others. Yet you are not really trying to claim your own rights or your own benefits and things like that to bring in. That's the problem.
Jonathan, appropriate that you should be the last question here. Maybe you can also figure out a way to wrap this into a bow.
Well, that's no light charge.
Neatly.
This is a really hard problem, I guess. I knew that before when I was trying to work on it with the study in the committee, and then I'd conveniently forgotten it, and now my brain is hurting again. And as I look at the solution that has been come up, because I understand that ICANN has had to decide, the board, between on one hand, they want to do it right, and that's really hard to do. And on the other hand, they just need to do it. That every day that goes by when they haven't done it is a day for which any other decision they make, somebody says, how dare you do this without an elective member, you know, an elective membership in place. So that's a terrible dilemma to be on the horns of. So the current solution we have is one that I haven't heard anybody willing to really fight for. Nobody's coming out and saying, this is great. Joe Sims comes up and says, this is a mess. Teresa, whom you'd think finally, Teresa would say, all right, we've got a membership, says, this is a mess. And even as I look at it, I see an intermediate council for which to try to get people in good faith to come together and vote for it. And they have more interest in voting for dog catcher than they will member of a council who in turn will elect board members to an organization that does things for which you've got to give them a 45-minute seminar. Or a stack of papers that they'll dutifully read to have them have any sense of what it does. So all this is to say, I guess you might say, if everybody hates it, maybe it's not such a bad compromise. But I incline actually to the other view, which is, no, we really have a problem here. I mean, it's a white elephant in the middle of the room, but there it is. It's a serious problem, and I say it as somebody who helped create it, not intentionally, but, you know, I've done my part to build this pie that nobody wants to eat. So the question then is, where do we go from here? And you just asked it. And in some ways, I think this ends up a little bit, whether he likes it or not, on Greg's lap. Greg is the member of the board who has been taking the most time to think hard about these issues. This is really, in a way, his baby, whether he likes it or not. And
we're sorry.
I know the board just recently took some action to have something in the bylaws other than this space intentionally left blank under Article 2 membership, which is what it used to say. And I don't know if what's there is better than a blank page. It's really hard to say. Now, the only hope I take from this is that people like Stephen Hill and Kent Graham and even Jerry Berman to some extent and the Markle Foundation are only now cavalry riding to the scene and inspecting the situation.
Annoying, aren't we?
Well, annoying in some sense, but also perhaps helpful. And while delay is always a terrible thing, and in fact, I'm sure we're delay there, Teresa might be tempted to say, how dare you delay membership yet again? It may be the better path with an explicit program that somehow we could hash out that would say, let's try the Constitution without waiting for the Articles of Confederation, which we all have this hunch is what we're sitting on right now, to actually fail.
Jonathan, I have a question.
Yes.
Is there a way to split the difference? Is there a way to take Kent's proposal that for some short period of time you have a sort of carefully selected
the extent we can figure out what representative group that, in fact, also represents a lot of those who are worried about this. They function as the board. We move towards actually finally having a board with an idea that...
That's called the initial board. I mean, that's what you have, but, all the warts it has.
Well, it is, except that initial board.
Except we are old, you know.
It is the initial board, but on the other hand, there wasn't an open... Greg, there wasn't an open and transparent process about how the initial board came to be.
What you could do is do what universities do, which is create a slate of like three people for each position, present that for choice.
For a plebiscite,
and then let them figure out
the rest of the bootstrapping to give it. Because I worry right now with the structure we have, whether it's Ben Edelman getting together 1,000 Harvard sophomores and taking over the at-large board that way. Not that he'd want to do it. I'm sure he wouldn't want to do it. Or if it's a company with a distinct interest, just calling one of the many numbers you can call in Washington and say, I need 5,000 voters, and fast, and you'll get your 5,000 voters, I'm convinced. And I need 3 from each state and 2 from each country.
Definitely doable.
Yeah, it's a question of how much you're willing to pay. Maybe this is the better path, and... I don't know. I'd want a reaction from Greg. If he's convinced of this,
Greg,
would he be willing to carry the water to the board and be the Nixon to go to China and
Nixon
say...
China, and Azumi, and Stephen, and then we're just going to have to end it, and we could have spent the day on this, which we knew. And do trois.
The board came into this with a brief that we had to establish a membership for ICANN, and we've gone about doing that, and this is what we've ended up with for a number of reasons. It's been asked what's the point of becoming an at-large member? It's the same point of becoming a member of an SO. You have the same rights and powers as a member of an SO. The difference is that the SOs have a particular interest because they are involved in the commercial and technical aspects of the Internet, so you expect to have people who are serious about the Internet participate in electing their councils and the councils in selecting their directors. If we can't get the individuals worldwide, enough of them to be as interested as the SO members are, then the at-large membership will not succeed and we'll have to think again. I think we're drawing a long bow to say here that it won't succeed, that there aren't a reasonable number of people who want to participate as users, domain name, individual domain name holders and whatever. I would not agree that we say, let's abandon it because we don't think it'll work. I think we should at least give it a try. If it doesn't work, the board's going to have to think again. The question about specifying what you want from the directors from the at-large constituency, we didn't do that any more than we specified what we wanted from the directors of the SOs. That is up to the electorate. In these sorts of situations, I won't call it a democracy, but in electoral systems, the electorate get the directors that they deserve.
Yes, as the member of the first MAC or MAC 1, in Berlin, we gave the recommendations that the current members be dismissed. So we actually retired. Yet we also suggested that board convene a new committee. And maybe some of the original members would remain or continue, so that we have some consistency as well as some new thought, which hasn't happened. I also volunteered to coordinate a meeting in Santiago for task force to implement a large member outreach and campaign, which hasn't really happened. The reason then given was money. We need 100,000 US funding. And the board sent on a letter, as you all know, to Marco. And I sort of, I appreciate that on the one hand, but on the other hand, I thought it's not politically correct. At large global membership be funded by only one American foundation, is it correct, without giving any opportunity for others? Board agree that we'll have some venue for others to come up with the funding, but nothing happened so far, including myself didn't do much. I was confused. And I hope that these implementation issues as well as the policy issues be in parallel discussed from now on, that the board will either convene the MAC 2 or something equivalent, not only to give the staff the discussion and counsel and give to the board on just on, you know, meetings like this, but more continuous effort to be did weekly conference call and things like that globally, and then report back to the rationales and the pros and cons to the other people so that it will have a very good policy view and include new views as well, and also a very pragmatic implementation side to, so that we don't be blamed that we are delaying that.
In terms of the membership drive, some people wonder, will people want to participate? Because if you say this organization is about registering a domain
name, not about much, right?
You're not going to get a lot of participation. But if you say this organization is about who oversees the root server of the domain name system and for the entire internet, I've been kind of surprised at how much that hasn't really been talked about today. I keep thinking, like, well, maybe I misread that somewhere. Maybe that isn't really what this organization does. What I read was that, like, if this organization were to decide that our organization's domain name, fairvote.org, doesn't exist, it doesn't exist, it dies. And so that's a pretty fundamental position to have on the internet. And so if you were to use that as your membership drive, that you're going to be electing the board that oversees it, I think you'll have way more than 5,000 people who are very, very interested in that. So, you know,
fine, I can, or it will hurt you.
Well,
right. And so, you know, I guess my final words to say that you have to make a fundamental decision about whether this is the appropriate board that needs to be elected democratically with representation, or whether it's this technical board that other people seem to think it is. It seems that there's a split on what this thing is. And as I said, the root server is a pretty important part of the internet. If you decide that you're going to do representative democracy here, I would recommend don't be timid. Make it truly a representative body and not something that is sort of putting a window dressing on it. And the reality is that it's going to be dominated by support organizations with a little bit of input occasionally from the at-large membership, because I think that's the structure that you have set up. It will be dominated by the support organizations with occasional input from the at-large membership.
If we go ahead with the structure that's in place, which there's been a lot of thought, a lot of consideration, a lot of work has gone into it, there is a mandate to get the rest of this board elected. So we go ahead. What's the worst thing that can happen? Is it fixable? I mean, if you wind up with a captured group, is there a way that we can think of some procedures to put in place now that allows us to deal with that? Or are we sort of locking in our mistake? Can we treat it as a laboratory and sort of say, whoops? Or,
well, look at the history of radio and television in this country. Radio started out as a very decentralized technology. And over time, it's, you know, become slowly aggregated in fewer and fewer hands. And, you know, there is a lot of commercial interest in being able to control the root server of the domain name part of the internet.
So from your perspective, if we went ahead and had this election, we're likely to wind up with capture, and they don't give it up once they get it, is what you're saying.
That's how, you know, from what I've seen, that's what I think.
Teresa?
I think that if the ICANN becomes captured primarily by corporate interests, the efforts to remove ICANN will be intensified, and ICANN will fall.
So ICANN can't let that happen because it's going to become
absolutely against ICANN's interests.
So there is a check out there for this.
I believe so.
Anybody else? Final question?
I think that ICANN will only continue to exist by the acceptance of its constituency, supporting organizations, everyone involved. If the board is captured in a way which acts inimical to the interests of the constituency, ICANN will cease to exist, cease to have any influence.
What I'm worried is captured by the U.S. government, maybe next administration. You can never know what's going to happen.
Thank you very much.
So let me give a few quick housekeeping notes. Point number one, you'll notice that there are some box lunches over here. If your time zone schedule is such that you feel it's lunchtime, I urge you to have a free lunch on us. These doesn't happen often, so please enjoy it. Also, I want to do something that we normally just wouldn't do because we'd just be ready to get out of here, but let me do it. I want to thank some of the people that have helped make this day take place. From the Center of Democracy and Technology, Jerry Berman and Alan Davidson, who helped shape particularly the privacy panel, but also other aspects of the day. from the Markle Foundation, Leslie Harris, who just moderated that panel so well, and Laura Balin, who's been working to put things together. And then also you'll notice the people studiously over here, they're not just answering their own email. They're helping keep everything running smoothly. That includes John Wilbanks, Meg Smith right here, who's a fellow of our center, Ben Edelman, who is keeping all the tech running just fine, and Tommy Graham, who came in on a Sunday to the Berkman Center in Boston to keep the tech running there. You'll also notice a book of analysis that was put together by the Harvard Law students that I think was quite helpful. Two of whom are here, Tony Lim, who was working the camera, and Becca Nessen. And finally, please, if I can just give a thank you, and if you can join me in thanking two people. One, Diane Cabell, who put really so much together and kept things running so smoothly. And also, the person who is in so many ways the spirit behind this, and certainly the spirit behind this format that we call the Socratic format as a way of getting to the base of ideas, and that is Charlie Nessen, who's right over there. He flew in last night from New York, and he's leaving in an hour to go right back.
And Jonathan.
Well,
thank you. I need an announcement. Somebody lost
it. Also, somebody left a piece of lovely jewelry at the rear of the room. If you'd like to have it, and it's yours, please come get it. You'll also notice the schedule of things tomorrow on the right screen, so you can see what else there may be coming up. Thank you.